Members of the committee will come to order. Good morning, everyone. Happy spring, first day of spring. You know you're in Minnesota when you get up on the first day of spring and you look out the window and there's fresh snow on you. On my way over, I stopped at one of my favorite breakfast places in my district. The owners are Persian, Iranian immigrants who've been in our nation for, 20, 30 years. Terrific people. Some of you have gone out and eaten there. It's a downtowner. And one of the gentlemen, when I was saying happy spring to him, explained that it was the Iranian, or rather, more accurately, the Persian New Year. And so today is their New Year Day. It's called Nowruz. Nowruz. So happy Nowruz to you all. I have no doubt that their number is probably something like the year 4000 something, one of our most ancient venerable cultures. So members, we are going to get started. We've got a very busy day. We have a number of things that we're going to be going through today. We have four or five bills. Let me get my sticker here. One, two, three, four, five bills, including the Department Policy Bill. We'll try to move as quickly and as efficiently as possible through the day so that we'll get you out of here by the, hopefully before the new time that we're scheduled to adjourn. But first off, let me get a piece of business done here with the Senator Abbey. If you would be so kind, the March 19th minutes.
Absolutely.
Representative Abbey moves adoption of the minutes of March 19th. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion fails. Thank you. Members, we're going to start today with a presentation. On the topic of House Panel 1. House Panel 1 was actually in possession of the Finance Committee, but we thought we would avail our opportunity of a special guest here to be able to talk about a provision that hopefully in the next committee, which a number of us serve on, we'll have an opportunity to act on. And so, Representative Bemmer, would you be so kind as to lead us through the discussion? And look forward to the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. And House File 1001 was heard yesterday, actually, in April of Finance. We had a very good discussion. We had a good chance to get a lot of things, so I appreciate that. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and visit with this committee also, which I also serve on. There are about 10 or 11, maybe 12 members that are not common between the two committees, and we all have an interest in education, and I think this is something that we will find very interesting. Basically, with House Bill, first of all, just a quick to tell everybody's got a copy of the bill. We don't have to do any moves for changing anything, but we did make a couple of changes. We did strike lines and line 2.17, starting at the word any and all grant monies. We did strike that sentence out of the bill yesterday. Fiscal staff, Mr. Marks in particular, was not comfortable with having something that's annually appropriated to be continuing ongoing. Pile up money, so to speak. So we took that part out. And we also took out the overall dollar amount, the $1.3 million and $1.8 million, with the idea that this is scalable in terms of how many we may want to fund or not. So we decided to leave that open. It was held over in the Finance Committee, and those figures will be put in as we assemble and put the bill together. So that's just for information.
Thank you.
Basically, what this bill is, Mr. Chair, and the concept is working with giving school districts some incentive, if you will, and some opportunity to fund a process. It's putting together a framework for excellence using the Minnesota Council for Quality and the Baldrige criteria to put together a framework within which the school district can build a systemic approach to achieving excellence in their school districts. And we have two grant opportunities. One's called the Diligence Grant, and basically would allow school districts to apply for, say, up to $20,000 to actually go through the application process within which they could be accepted and put a proposal together. And if they get their proposal together, and if they're awarded a level of achievement based on the criteria of the Baldrige, which we'll hear about, and the Council for Quality, they could then be eligible for what's called role model grants, which would be a number to be determined, maybe up to $250,000 for a school district to actually go out and talk with other school districts, not about how that district can be excellent, but about how they can set up a framework for determining their own excellence. And so, so that's in essence what the proposal is about. And with that, I'll quit talking. I do have a couple of guests here that will know way more about this than I do. And I think Mr. Chair will give them a chance to speak.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Chairman. I'm Merlin Riglis from Rochester, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and thank you for inviting us back.
Welcome to the seminar.
As some of you probably know, and a few don't, I'm an independent consultant with a strong focus on education. Have worked with clients and colleges and universities all across the U.S., and since 1995, primarily in Asia. So it's a special pleasure to be here this morning and to be able to contribute to the United States, to the state of Minnesota. With activities that we have experience with, we've implemented in my professional career and in Asia in the last several years. My background is also IBM, senior leadership in research, strategic planning, new product development. And my last assignment at IBM Rochester was the divisional leadership role in IBM Rochester, winning the 1990 Malcolm Long Reach National Quality Award, which is the foundation for the proposal that we have here today. You mentioned your schedule is tight, and it's quite obvious you have a number of things on your docket, so I will be brief. My main point, I think, today is there are three messages that I would like you and the group to take away today. And the first one is that what we're proposing today is, I think, profound. Profound in the sense that we're not proposing a set of programs. Programs, in my mind, have a beginning, it's an activity, they come to an end, and then you can passively participate, and eventually they can go away. What we're talking about here is instituting a way of life into our school system such that they can learn how to achieve more with less, which is exactly the kind of environment that we're in today. The second message that I would like to have the group take away today, Randy articulated, but let me just clarify that it's simple. It's simple. It only has two parts. The first part is an incentive to encourage and help school districts participate with the Minnesota Quality Council for Quality to learn the processes, to learn this way of life, for how to do more, how to achieve more with less. The second part of it is the role model part, which is then to identify those school districts which are the highest achievers, identify them as role models, and then make some funding available so they can communicate to others, as Randy indicated. And those others, obviously, are school districts. You would call it peer teaching. But those others also might be our teacher colleges. They might even be the legislature in terms of teaching all of us what are the best practices and how to provide education, improve teaching and learning, reducing the achievement gap, and improving administrative efficiency. All of those things are possible. The third point today, I think, that I'd like you to take away is that now is the time to implement this. Even though this concept has been brewing, at least in my mind, for like 15 years now, when I was part of the Malcolm Baldrige activity to adapt the business process to education, which was done in the early mid-1990s, today I think is really the opportune time to introduce this. You all know as well as we do, we have a financial crisis, we have an education crisis, and it's expedient that we introduce the kind of processes that the Baldrige offers to again help our educational organization to be able to achieve more with less. So with that, we request your support and your action. We think it's timely to move forward. Oh, and I might add, common term we hear a lot about today is being shovel ready. Clearly, we have something to offer you here that is shovel ready. The processes, the criteria, they're proven, they're in place, they're established. The organizations that implement this are highly respected, the Minnesota Council for Quality, our own Department of Education, and we also have several enthusiastic school districts across the state of Minnesota that are eager to participate in this activity. Some of them already are. So with that, I'd like to turn it over then to Brian Lassiter, who can provide you with more details on how the process actually works.
Thank you, Dr. Rickless. Mr. Lassiter. Is it Lassiter or Lassiter?
Lassiter.
I have an extra S on my agenda.
Well, I
can't hold anybody, so. An extra S isn't the worst of it.
That's not the worst of it.
Well, good morning.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee, for hearing us. I do appreciate your time today, and I know your time is short, so I'll make my remarks as brief as possible. I'm Brian Lassiter, President of the Minnesota Council for Quality. Recognize some faces from the hearing we had yesterday. The Minnesota Council for Quality is a nonprofit organization founded in 1987, actually by legislative action here in the state of Minnesota. Spun off into a 501c3 in 1989. Our mission, really, for those 22 years has remained fairly steady, but helping Minnesota organizations improve their performance and reach higher levels of excellence. We have about 300 members, most of them organizations, representing about 150,000 employees in the state. I was elected president in the summer of 2001. I also serve as a volunteer for the Malcolm Walters National Quality Award. This is my 12th year of volunteer service in the program. The Walters program itself was created by an act of Congress in 1987, and the purpose at the time was to improve business performance and competitiveness on a worldwide basis. Manufacturers embraced the model first, framework then grew into the service sector, and businesses still embrace the framework as a way to improve their performance, but what I label as non-businesses, schools, both K-12 and higher ed, healthcare organizations, nonprofits, even governmental agencies are now using the framework to improve their performance and outcomes. Baldrige is really about five things. About helping leaders identify strengths and improvement opportunities within their system. About facilitating organizational improvement, alignment, and integration. Assisting in the delivery of value to stakeholders, which includes students and other stakeholders in education. Facilitating organizational and personal learning, and monitoring progress over time. It's a common misconception that the Baldrige program is about an award. I think the award is important, but it's very secondary to the learning and the improvement of outcomes of results that take place in this process. Baldrige is a framework. It represents six different process categories and one category dealing with outcomes, results, and all types of outcomes. Certainly academic outcomes in the education setting, but all non-academic outcomes are also included in this framework. Operations, productivity, workforce effectiveness, student stakeholder satisfaction, leadership effectiveness, those types of outcomes. So it's its own balanced scorecard, if you're familiar with that term, for measuring and monitoring the performance of an organization. Under the categories sit validated criteria. And they're validated because they change every 2 years by studying organizations that have demonstrated high performance results and figuring out what those organizations are doing, and that becomes teacher's criteria. So it's become a de facto set of best practices that organizations can gauge their own performance against. Organizations that use Baldrige typically conduct an assessment, either through a third-party organization like ours, the national program, or independent consultants, or many are using the criteria as a self-assessment guide just to diagnose themselves and get better, identifying what they can improve. We have a volunteer board of evaluators of about 130 individuals statewide coming from all over the state, all different types of organizations. We have CEOs and senior executives. We have physicians and surgeons and RNs. We have superintendents and school teachers. We have nonprofit executives, public sector servants, all different types of individuals. We're trained by us and then conduct assessments to help organizational leaders identify what to improve against these criteria. There's a lot of evidence that the criteria are helping organizations, particularly school districts, improve performance. There have been five recipients of the Malcolm Walters National Quality Award in the K-12 sector. None from Minnesota, unfortunately, although a few getting close. And there have been three higher ed institutions nationwide receive this level of distinction from the presence of the United States. I'll leave you a copy of my transcript, as I did in yesterday's hearing, that has some documented evidence of the performance results of these high-performing organizations. And like I said earlier, it's not just academic achievement, but it's budgetary and financial outcomes. It outcomes, workforce-related outcomes, community-related outcomes. Qualtrics is heavily used in the state of Minnesota as well, and I should mention we're one of 37 state quality work programs that are modeled after the national program. There have been 102 recipients of our Qualtrics-based Minnesota Quality Award since its first award level was given in 1991. Businesses are still using the framework. As I mentioned, a growing number of non-businesses are now using the framework. In fact, there have been 15 K-12 school districts in the state of Minnesota that receive some level of recognition in the Minnesota Quality Award. We estimate at least 20 to 25 school districts across the state are already using Qualtrics to help improve their performance. I believe it's a powerful, proven way to help educational leaders identify what to improve in their system so that they can focus their energy and resources on those quote-unquote right things to get better not only academically, but to eliminate waste, to improve productivity and efficiency, and to better leverage the resources they already have. I believe, as Merlin said, there's no better time to use this innovative approach that has worked in business to improve the effectiveness of our schools. With that, I'll hold my... I'd be happy to take your questions after, I think, the third expert to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Lester.
Thank you very much.
We'll move on to the third testifier, but I know we do have a couple of questions already in mind.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ann Nelson. I was asked to come today because I am one of scores of Minnesota volunteers that work at the state level, Minnesota Council for Quality to help schools, as well as the national level. And like many volunteers, I've worked in Minneapolis, Minnesota school for 30 years as a high school English teacher, assistant principal, principal, assistant superintendent, superintendent, and now for 3.5 years at the Department of Education as the assistant commissioner for academic excellence. But I'm here because I wanted to tell you as a volunteer, it wasn't until the 7th year of my 9 years in Fridley as a superintendent that I came across the Qualtrics program. There are programs of the week that come and go for teachers and principals in the school. And this one is so strong because it's a template. And it doesn't tell those who are thinking leaders who are also savvy in ways of how you have to work so hard to implement improvements when you have students coming in. This is a template that asks you to take a look at, if you look on your book page, Roman numeral 4, that little Roman numeral 4 at the beginning of the book. There's a visual there that says it all. And when you're working with Qualtrics, you are asked to do some self-assessment with your leadership team that includes people across the district. You look at your organizational environment. How are you handling your key relationships with students and parents and stakeholders? What is your system for performance improvement? What are your strategic advantages as a school district? What are the challenges you face? You look at what the legislature's goals are. You look at what your school board goals are. You'll see that in this chart on page 4, there are 7 items: leadership, strategic planning, customer focus, workforce focus, process management, data management and measurement, and then results. What is so key about this is there are key questions for every one of those. For example, under leadership, you have to answer about 10 questions for yourself. How do we lead and sustain this organization? How do we communicate with the workforce about the importance of student improvement? And how do we communicate with them to develop workplace excellence? There's a place for boards. What is our governance system? How do we even improve? Are we legally doing everything we can? Are we ethical in how we treat our stakeholders and people within the system? Under strategic planning, how do we convert our challenges and our advantages to action plans? Workforce engagement. Are we really engaging our teachers and all of those who work for us? Are we getting them involved so they can see that they are part of the decision making? How do we encourage high performance on the part of our employees? They're the gold in any system. How do we encourage them to be better? This is not telling them how. You have to answer these questions. What do we do? And how do we do it? And by the process of answering these questions, you need more time about what you could be doing a whole lot better. One of the things I think in my 30 years in the ministry, we're not so good on process management. Well, we can improve in all of the areas, but the process instruction goal. So that the work of the teacher is made better and easier, and the connection between what they do is tied to what I do in the faculty meeting and how we structure the way we have our staff development days. This is a template that is so helpful, and I wish I told my friends at the department and Brittany when I was there with the superintendent. I so wish I had had a course in the Welch principle when I was learning how to be a superintendent. And now that I've spent 30 years in school, I am very proud to volunteer without pay to be on the state judges panel for the Council for Quality. And I'm proud to be starting my fourth year at the national level as an examiner and work every site with a person taking a look at our education. I have learned so much. If this legislation were passed, we could offer the opportunity for thinking and savvy and caring administrators with their teacher leaders to get a good, hard, critical look at their organization. And having worked with many of you, before I retired in 2007, I know how much you care about how effective our schools can be in improving student learning. And this is a template that will work for organization performance excellence. And there's scores of people at home who want to help schools to do it without pay, just because we know it's right in the system.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Nelson. It's good to see you again. Representative Demmer, I think that's your testifiers. I do know we have this one question. I suspect we'll have some more. Representative Brannard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer. This isn't so much, I guess there is a question here, but I'll start with a comment. I'm very aware of the Baldrige model. Our school district looked at it twice, very extensively. We spent a two-day retreat looking at considering adopting the Baldrige model because we were very aware of its success in Rochester. And we decided to stick with our MCA process, the North Central Accreditation. And I'll start by revealing that I've served as a public representative on the state MCA committee for a number of years. But my question is, and I think this is something we should move forward to, but I'm wondering if we ought not to open it to other templates. Baldrige is a very powerful template for effective strategic reorganization, looking at your all levels within, you know, but so are other templates, and the North Central Accreditation offers a very powerful template that many school districts in our state use, and many school districts have had to face the financial issue of do they consider to continue with NCA because they have to pay, you know, the fees to do so. So I would like, if we go forward with a grant program like this, to set some criteria where there are other possible programs that could qualify for this grant, because currently NCA offers a program very similar to Baldrige in its comprehensive approach. It's a district accreditation process. It functions at all levels within the organization. It's very parallel. It's a standards-based process. You know, there's a book that applies to every level of the organization. So my question is, could we consider expanding this type of approach to other programs that are equally able to deliver the product that
Baldrige
does?
Representative Demmer, and I see that Mr. Bassett has also joined us here at the table, perhaps, for this question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Brannard, I would agree with you. As those of you who have served with me know that I have spoken up about not putting specific programs in statute, but in conceptual things, so that other programs that either exist today or could come along would be eligible. The one thing that did draw me to this, however, was the Minnesota Council for Quality, which is an organization that was created by the legislature to work on behalf of quality in Minnesota. So I was drawn to the fact that they are here for that reason. And working through an organization that we have, and I'll let Mr. Lasser speak to that, that drew me to this. And, of course, my familiarity with Baldrige as a school board member in Hayfield. Back in the 90s, we started a program and started going through it. I was so impressed at that time because we had... I had no clue where to go with this conceptual thing. I guess my brain maybe wasn't broad enough for this. But I was so impressed by the leadership that we got through the Baldrige volunteers to guide us through this process. And and what it did in terms of helping us not just make decisions, but figure out how to make decisions and how to think about our school district and how to think about everybody going. I always remember the arrows going all the same direction, the scatter diagram that they had with arrows pointing all over to draw out our agendas, and how it was about aligning those so we go toward a common goal. And I was so impressed with that. And when I became aware of this, when actually Mr. Rick was contacting me, and I said, well, yeah, I think we're involved in just learning about the Minnesota Quality, the Council of Quality, and I thought, this is something we have in place that should be very common. So I don't disagree, and I think that there's a room for doing that sort of thing. So,
Mr. Lasseter.
If I may just respond, thank you, Representative. I agree with your position, and I'm familiar with the NCA and with the North Central Accrediting Body. In fact, the North Central has adopted something called AQIP and NCLIP in the state of Minnesota that allows organizations, higher ed institutions, to use the Baldrige framework as a proxy for accreditation. And I actually believe that will happen in other sectors as well. There's consideration for JFL certification for healthcare organizations using this framework. In a real simple term, my belief is that all of these accrediting bodies exist to certify a minimum standard of performance within an educational institution, a healthcare institution, and so forth. Whereas the Baldrige framework is trying to help organizations reach higher levels of excellence. And so while the criteria, or the standards, if you will, are very complementary and very similar, the intended purpose is different. One is trying to bring an organization to a certain level of performance, minimum level of performance, and the other is trying to help you reach higher levels of excellence.
I hear what you're saying, but I challenge you to look at the current North Central model, because they really have moved beyond a minimal level of accreditation to a high standard level. So, and my point isn't to try to, in no manner, trying to pit Baldrige against North Central, because I think districts make choices for their improvement plans based on a whole gestalt of factors, and I am for local control there. What I would ask is that we're making this grant opportunity available at the state level, that other organizations be allowed to make the case for meeting the standard.
Representative Deputy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lasseter, you mentioned that there were 15 schools in Minnesota and then 25 that are either applying or certainly using some of the things that you're talking about. Can you provide this committee with the list of those schools in Minnesota that are currently using your program?
Mr. Lasseter.
Yes, in fact, I believe it should have been a handout. If not, we can provide the committee with that list.
I have it.
There you go.
Thank you very much. Sorry.
Any other questions, observations? Representative Demmer, any final thoughts for the committee?
No, I wish I had final thoughts, Mr. Chair.
I know you do, Mr. Chair.
No, first of all, I want to thank you. I know this is informational. I know we have a tight schedule. And I told you this before. I honestly believe this. It was referred to finance. I have to go there and understand that this is where this kind of thing should be talked about. This is conceptual. It's about the policy. As I mentioned before, I did participate in the process myself, and again, it's not about achieving an award, it's about establishing a framework. And done properly with the guidance of the folks working on this, this framework is not something that is a program that you finish and you're done with. It really transcends it transcends other education programs you might have. There was a pretty good discussion regarding QCOP, which St. Beaker brought up yesterday in April on finance. You know, how does that fit in? And, you know, QCOP is a program that I support and we don't have discussions about, but over time there will be something that will transcend QCOP and that sort of thing. People will come and go within our districts, whether it's us here, whether it's superintendents, principals, teachers will come, you know, those sorts of things. Most people come and go. Then properly, something like the Baldrige process is something that transcends all of that, because it takes into account those changes and allows a district and an organization, in this case the school district, to continue to move forward with excellence. And it transcends all these other programs. This is the framework within which the people and the programs and the processes that we do are continually evaluated, continually overhauled. And so, again, framework is the best thing I can come up with, because that's what it works. And I mentioned this in the committee yesterday, and I'll say it again here for the benefit of those were here before, but it occurred to me that the legislature could benefit from what's been involved in the process. And if we could do that, we have some different circumstances here with our politics, but it occurred to me that getting it in one direction would be quite challenging and really quite rewarding if we could do that. We've done it this time. So again, I really appreciate the opportunity to present this. We have some excellent people here, some good professionals, and get their score and see some work. Thank you.
Representative Denner, I suspect Representative McFarland and Representative Swales could probably lead that effort in the legislature based on what I heard from the joint testimony yesterday in terms of working your way competently through to some good policy recommendations here. Members, I think we should seriously consider these ideas and these proposals all within the spirit of increasing the effectiveness of our K-12 system. And I think we come at that from many different ways, but I think they're all quite possibly very complementary. And obviously we spend a lot of time here as a legislature focused on, much more of a purely academic outcomes and expectations. So we set standards, we prescribe ways in which we think our districts get toward delivery of those standards, but we're also, it's helpful to be reminded that we're talking about institutional structures, human structures, that because they are structures, can certainly benefit from organizational effectiveness enhancement processes. And so I think there's a lot of complementary efforts here, and I think the spirit is all the same. And obviously, we're coming at it from this particular framework that we can't play a role for addressing the issue in terms of trying to fine-tune our academic standards. So I look forward to the ongoing discussion in Representative Bradley's committee relative to this proposal. I think we'll continue to enrich our efforts here to help guide our K-12 schools. Well, thank you, Representative Demery, Mr. Lassiter, Dr. Nicholas, and Dr. Nelson for your testimony this morning. With that, members, we're going to move on to House File 1621, Representative Daphne. We have two bills in succession that are related insofar that they both deal with special ed issues, special education issues. And I know that a number of us have been greatly anticipating hearing from both your bill and Senator Newman's bill, because we understand that both of those bills are products of a lot of tough but very good and very committed collegial collaborative efforts on the parts of a broad array of very good and very invested stakeholders. So, and dealing with very difficult issues. So, with that, Representative Abney, I think we will entertain a motion and hear formally from you to move House File 1621. We recommend it to pass, and our intent would be to lay the soldier for possible inclusion in an omnibus educational policy bill. And if that's not correct, we'll correct it before the end of the testimony.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Before we get into testimony on the bill, I would like to move the H1621 DE1 amendments.
So, Gabby moves the DE1 amendment, and this is. Yeah, sir, your bill, I'm told that you're probably going to formally move your bill.
I'd like to move the H1621 to be before the committee. Recommended to pass and laid over for possible.
Very well. And now it says that it goes to DE1 amendment, and this is a delete all amendment which puts the bill in the shape the author wishes it to be before us. So, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Well, sent back.
Mr. Chair, let me thank you for the thoughtful comments regarding the path to the creation of this bill over the last 9 months. But let me be clear, none of the kind words go to me. They all go to folks in the special education community who have done the hard work of working for community consensus on a difficult and troubling issue, and that is the use of seclusion and restraint in our schools on children with disabilities and significant behavioral challenges. These children often go back and forth between day treatment programs, in-home therapies, residential programs, and schools. One of the goals of this bill is to have consistency across those different settings to the greatest extent possible, both in terms of language used as well as procedures used. This is a nationwide issue. A report released by the National Disability Rights Network called School Is Not Supposed to Hurt found a patchwork of laws and regulations that do not adequately protect children. 41% of the states have no laws whatsoever regarding the use of seclusion and restraint, and there are troubling stories documented from around the country, including as up close by as Wisconsin, and some difficult stories even out of our own state here in Minnesota.
So, Ben, did you say 21 states?
41% of the whole states. I haven't done
the
math. Yeah, you've done the math, I haven't. There are laws and rules in place for residential and community-based providers. In fact, just last year, the legislature passed a bill governing community mental health providers for children. There were no objections to that bill. That bill served as a starting point for this bill. As a teacher and as a former psychiatric ward employee who was involved in seclusion and restraint techniques there, I understand the seriousness of these procedures and yet understand the need to strike a balance and to make it not so cumbersome for teachers that they cannot keep students and others safe in our schools. I think what we have here is, shall we call it a dynamic compromise, one in progress, and I will assure committee members that I will continue to work with members of the special education community and families with concerns as this bill moves along. I would now like to ask Sue Aberholden from Nami, Minnesota, to walk through the bill.
Maureen, Ms. Aberholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sue Aberholden, Executive Director of Nami, Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness. Before I walk through the bill, I just need to say, take a few minutes of your time. I just want to say how important this issue is. I've spent the last 2 years talking to family members, youth who've been put in a seclusion room or restraint, talking to professionals and experts across the country and within our own state, both in the education community and the mental health community. And I really do believe that we put together a really good bill that balances both the constraints of school districts but also the needs of kids. In the mid-1980s, I actually came before the legislature when I worked then for ARCA Minnesota, and we passed what is now commonly called the Rule 40 bill, which limits the use of certain types of procedures. We limited, and you'll see some of those prohibitions in the bill, and that all came from that time. And I can tell you back then there was a lot of opposition. We were using Tabasco sauce on kids' tongues at the time. We were even using breath and shock or foul pods. There was actually, during that time, testimony against us outlawing the use of breath and skin shock because people said they thought it worked. Now, we would think that would be barbaric. And I think what that just says is that over time, even our behavioral interventions change as we learn, as we study, and as we do research. I just want to tell you that there is no research out there. That says the use of physical restraint and seclusion will actually teach children to learn something new. It's just not there. You have a packet here, and what it does is it has on the cover is the cover of the report, School Is Not Supposed to Hurt. Again, there was actually a congressional hearing in January because of this, so this is now becoming a nationwide issue. One thing we're not going to do today is to place out a number of parents who have horror stories to tell you. If we really want you to look at what the, kind of the underlying issues are and what best practice is. But in the first two sheets, I did include the WCCO IQ report where they documented the misuse of the seclusion rooms. We also have in there frequently asked questions. The IQ report actually produced a list of all the schools in Minnesota that have seclusion rooms. And I didn't print it out for you today, but you can see there's lots of them. It's about 117. So there are a lot of rooms out there. There are a lot of support from various organizations, the Minnesota Society for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, Coalition of Children with Disabilities, the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agency, the Autism Society of Minnesota, ARPA Minnesota, Dr. Rick Amato, who's a licensed psychologist and many school districts use him. I have a letter here from the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs that was delivered to me at 8:30 this morning. And Minnesota School Psychologists also support this. We have an article on restraints and how dangerous they are. And lastly, information on the National Alliance of Organizations to reduce these types of procedures. So I'll go through the bill now. You'll see that Section 2, we define emergency. This was a compromise. To be honest, the advocacy community wanted to limit emergency to a child who's going to injure themselves or others. We left in to prevent serious property damage. We actually felt that if you were going to use serious property damage, you were going to hurt yourself or others. And we were afraid that that might kind of move into if a kid just, you know, kicked over a chair, that they would use seclusion and restraint. But we put that in as a compromise. We talked about positive behavioral interventions and supports, which of course is what we want to be promoting. Physical holding, what that is, and making sure that things that you would want to be physical holding, like simply guiding a child, or if you're, you know, needing to do some kind of, you know, health-related procedure with them in the school, that none of that counts, including physical escort. We define restrictive procedures, which basically are just physical holding or seclusion. We talk about what seclusion is, which is really putting a child in a locked room. It's not timeout. It's not, you know, Mandy 911. This is a room where you, you know, block a child with egress. We need to find time out just to make sure people know. On Section 3, we've set up standards for restrictive procedures. Schools have to maintain, you know, kind of a publicly accessible document about what kind of procedures they're going to use in their school and how they're going to do those. It could be part of their total special education plan, or it could be another document. The plan has to list out the type of procedures they intend to use, how they'll monitor those procedures, a written description, verification that the staff have received proper training, how they're going to periodically review them. You want to make sure you do review so that you can reduce the use of seclusion and restraint. And when you're reviewing them, you want to look at, you know, if there were injuries, if there were deficiencies in the school. You want to look at it both on an individual level and a school basis. It may be that everything's happening in the lunchroom, right? Everything's happening with a particular substitute teacher, and you want to be able to know that. Under Subdivision 2, we talk about who can use restrictive procedures. We are talking about people who are licensed, a licensed special education teacher, licensed social worker, school psychologist, et cetera. But they also have to complete special training. Just because you go through those programs doesn't mean you actually learn those techniques that can de-escalate the situation. A school must make reasonable efforts to notify parents on the same day. I think you should note that we said reasonable efforts. Because we know that sometimes that can be difficult. Again, that was a compromise that we worked out. Under Subdivision C, basically what we're saying is that when you use one of these restrictive procedures twice in 30 days or when a pattern emerges, then you need to call that IEP team together to find out what's going on, that now we have to start using these kinds of procedures. And one of the things we want to make sure that they do is to look at if are there any known medical or psychological limitations that contraindicate this future use of these procedures. If you have a child who's been, frankly, sexually abused, you're not going to want to do physical holding. For some children as well, you don't want to put them in seclusion. It really is contraindicated. You want to make sure that you look that over. We then talk about, and under D and E, we allow school districts to plan for an emergency. We tell families of children with mental illness all the time, you want to plan for an emergency, and so we allow school districts to use this. But you only can use these procedures in an emergency. So you can plan for it, but it's not part of your behavior intervention plan. You're just planning ahead for a crisis. Under Subdivision 3, we talk about, again, physical holding and seclusion can only be used in an emergency. It has to be the least intrusive intervention that effectively responds to the emergency. It must end when the threat of harm ends. So you don't say, well, we'll do this for 15 minutes and let you out. As soon as that child calms down or stops doing whatever behavior it was, that's when you let them out. The staff have to consistently or constantly directly observe the child. You want to make sure that nothing's happening, that they're not further injuring themselves. And then there's documentation requirements. You need to write down what happened, you know, what preceded that behavior, how long did you use it. We do have on line 3.3.1, we talk about the standards for seclusion room because you want to make sure that we're not putting kids in dangerous closets or, you know, anything like that. If you turn the page, we also say that those rooms have to have doors that either automatically open or are tied into an emergency system to ensure that that would happen, that, you know, in a fire or something like that. Under subdivision 4, you'll see the long list of prohibitions. These prohibitions are consistent with all the other rules that we have out there when it's children's mental health providers, residential treatment providers, Department of Corrections, and for people with developmental disabilities. Under subdivision 5 is the training for staff, and we think that this is one of the really important pieces of the legislation. Police will tell you that when they get the crisis intervention team training, that they really have a new tool for de-escalating situations, and we're asking that this be done to board teachers or licensed personnel who are already using these procedures. So if you're in the school that's not going to use these procedures at all, then you don't have to do any of this. Because if you are going to do them, you need to make sure you have the training. And on records, we're just asking that the aggregate data be available and given to the commissioner, and so that we have an annual report so we can actually get a handle on how many of these procedures are being used. We've repealed the existing rules and legislation. And lastly, I just want to point out that we're making this effective July 1st, 2010, because we know it'll take about a year to really get staff up and trained to be able to use these procedures.
Yes, I would like to thank you for giving us a very quickly and also very shortly to the
Mr. Chair, we have two testifiers with us today.
There is one. Okay. You can grab over the chairs to the side. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Antoinette Johns. I'm Director of Special Education currently at the Northeast Central Intermediate School District. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today on behalf of House File 1621. Our intermediate school district has 10 member school districts, but we actually serve students from 30 school districts on an annual basis. And our programs are known as that directly serve kids in our site as federal setting for the most severely disabled. Their primary disability may be cognitively delayed, it may be emotionally and behaviorally disordered, or autism spectrum. Those students we find often have a comorbidity of mental health illness issues in recent years. Over the last couple of years, our school superintendent, Connie Hayes, has had numerous conversations with people, including Representative Jerome McFarland about a year ago, about the severity of the students that we're serving and the aggressiveness and types of students that currently are being referred. They discussed the issues of student safety and they're having a just very significant disruptive event and the safety of their own peers and staff. For our emotionally and behaviorally disabled students, about 85% of them on an ongoing basis have a probation officer due to felonious, criminal acts in the community, being a sexual predator, or other issues within the community. Recently, before you, Superintendent Lewandowski in District 287 presented information about how difficult the students are that are coming to school today and how serious are their needs when she was requesting that the intermediate districts have access to state school dollars. Some of you may have seen that. And those are the students that I'm talking about today in our level of service. We're supporting this bill because we believe it addresses many of the issues that have needed clarification in language and utilization throughout school districts to require school districts to more clearly use the schools and more clearly use the specified standards and information that we're supposed to use. And this is important. We agree with the definition of information safety because we do not support the use of physical holding or seclusion, except in an immediate intervention is needed in order to protect that student, other students, or staff in our programs from physical injury or serious effects of injury. We understand that currently, in order to maintain school safety, that there is the use of reasonable force allowable under 128582 and 609379. But there's no research, as was stated, that supports the utilization of restraints and seclusion in changing the student's behavior and teaching them the means of behaving or resolving their issues. So that's why we have functional behavior analysis for our students and we proactive behavior management plan to change behavior in our education settings. But this is only meant to be used by us and is currently used in the country as we design. This bill sets out our staff training requirements and ensures that only appropriately trained staff can shift and alter all the school district intervene. Further, this bill outlines an accountability process and components to be written into a plan. In our district, we intend to maintain the total special education system plan even though it is in the future because it does give us a comprehensive system plan. And this bill outlines the components that would be written into there to hold us accountable. The National Department of Education Monitoring Division can look at these plans and hold you accountable for appropriate implementation, as they did to us in 2008-09 school year with this class injury. This bill not only requires a high standard of documentation when our risk procedures are implemented, it requires a site and district to review periodically the entire process of removing the use of the procedures, the implementation of them, the training, and the documentation records that we keep on it, as well as the outcomes and results. I think this is important. Not one of us would want to go to a doctor that didn't periodically review their procedures, their safety methods, and the effectiveness of their intervention and procedures. And we're professionals that should be held accountable for review of those goals. This bill requirements align current with current practices in our immediate school district and was MDD approved and monitored last year in our school district. And what we're finding too, and I think this is important, is that while our student population is becoming more aggressive, has more severe criminal records, and greater mental illness comorbidities, we are using this process less often, and then we use it for less amount of time per student. And we have consistent documentation on each and every student. This bill will be consistent in language and process for our students and their families, who move an unbelievable amount between school and residential or correctional facilities, and then return to our school. There's a movement within the community to not incarcerate children for long periods of time, but it also has meant that while they're not incarcerated, they are in our schools for the same behaviors that would have caused them to have been incarcerated. And we are being effective in our change of behavior, but we do miss this concept. And with that, that's the message. I thank you for the opportunity to speak here because I think that this bill is necessary and will bring consistency across all school settings and it will hold us to a higher standard.
Thank you, Superintendent Jones. Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be very brief today. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education, who I do some legislative work for, and they are in support of a lion's share of what's in 1621. But the organization could not reach a consensus on the tightening up or the prohibition of the lock time on seclusion. There are some schools that build it into the IEPs there are some directives rather that do build it in and do feel that this goes a bit too far in prohibiting the use of some of those issues. But clearly, we want to really thank Sue Abderholden here for convening this group and showing leadership on it. Again, as Dr. John said, the training parts of this are extremely important. One of the things I think both in here and with the RTI, with the PBIS, the early intervention services that are available, that are about being promoted by the Department of Education, clearly can play in here as well. But we do have subsets within the MACE organization that can't come to a consensus on the use of timeout. And that is why we just wanted to say that we support the lion's share of the bill, but can't come to a consensus on that one, unfortunately. And I could bring in people to discuss that, but we'd be here till next spring.
And this is now contrary to public opinion, we don't want to be here till next spring.
Mr. Chair, we're available for questions.
I do know that I have two other individuals who have asked to testify, but perhaps we could take a quick time out at this point. Testimony, rather. Oh, poor choice of words.
Mr. Chair, I would remind the chair and the committee there's a difference between a timeout and seclusion and restraint.
Thank you. Great opportunity for teaching. Let's take a few questions of the testifiers up to this point, and then we'll move on with some others who are issuing out the testimony. Representative Biden.
Chair, and this question is open to Mr. Rendell or Ms. Abderholden. I'm wondering if there's any research base for the difference of opinion on whether the requirements you're applying here to narrowing the timeout or restrictions, or whether it's simply a pragmatic issue of managing students.
Ms.
Abderholden. There's no research showing, again, that the use of seclusion and restraint changes the behavior of teaching the child anything different. Which is why in the bill we allow it to be used for emergencies, but we don't want it to be part of the regular education plan because it doesn't change the behavior.
My follow-up would be you had conversation with some of these special ed directors who have a different opinion and what you're discussing with that difference.
I've actually spoken with a major researcher at the University of Indiana who has tried to find studies. He found many studies from many years ago involving, two to five kids, certainly not, a full-blown research study. So there's just no research to support it. I think sometimes, I'm not going to compare it to graduate students, but in terms of people saying, oh, but I've done it, and I see that it works. All it does is when you put a child in a physical holding and you put in seclusion, eventually they begin to stop, they're calming down. But it doesn't mean that you taught them to not do that, to have that same reaction in the future. So I think that, I hear all the time over here about what research supports doing that. There's plenty of research that supports the positive behavior intervention programs that are being implemented across the district. There's tons of research on how that works. This does not work in terms of changing behavior.
Mr.
Rondell,
you want to weigh in on this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reiner, I can give you names beyond my level of expertise. I'm a logist and not a special educator, so I would say that I can get you names of people that have the contrary opinion and have them call you to provide that information, provide their viewpoint for you. I'm not in a position to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment first, and then I do have a question on the bill. This whole discussion, I'm sure the process that you went through was extremely thorough, and I appreciate that. It looks like a great bill relative to the circumstances that we're facing, but this whole discussion just prompts to me the challenge that we're putting on our schools, and my comment is way bigger than this bill, so take it for what it's worth. But, we're asking our teachers to teach kids English, we're asking our schools to feed kids who aren't well fed, we're asking them to provide basic socialization, we're asking them to integrate cultural and racial groups. We're asking them to empower the disabled. We're now asking them to keep our kids from getting obese. We're asking them to teach our kids basic values. And so here we sit now, we're asking our teachers to somehow discern these very difficult issues around mental illness. And anyway, just I want people to recognize the challenge that we place on our teachers and our schools right now with the scope of the mission that we're asking of them. So with that, it's just an overall comment that I had to get off my chest. The real question is, what does this do relative to legal liability, either for the teachers themselves or for the schools? Should they misinterpret or misdiagnose or misapply the procedures?
This side of the
world. I actually think that this adds due protection. We've not had a child die yet in the mental school community. That has happened in other states, including in Wisconsin. And I think because we're aligning, we're really creating a community standard about, here's what we do across all these different systems. This is the community standard. We're following these community standards. And I actually think that when you have this training, you're able to actually carry these procedures out in a much safer way, which is, again, I think a huge protection for both the teachers and licensed personnel and the school district itself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you're actually thinking that this could actually reduce liability as compared to increasing.
Mr. Chairman, if you know how to properly do this, you have a kid who has, serious asthma, you hold the child the wrong way, you can't suffer this down. So, knowing how to do this correctly and knowing how to prevent abuse from this, I think is a huge safety issue.
Thank you, Representative Downey, and I hear your opening comments, and I think they're fair, and I would offer that those expectations come less as a result of what we decide here collectively, and more as a result of the nature of our society, and how we produce certain outcomes in the broad social context, which have every bearing on not only our K-12 school, but all our other social structures as well, which I guess probably suggests that the solutions to them help solely, not solely in legislative action, but also in constant social adjustment that in many ways falls outside of our ability of power to legislate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Pastor Holden, I'm so appreciative of you. I want you to hear me say that loud and clear, because I know that you are passionate about mental health, and our many discussions we've had related to my hospital bill for Gary St. John's, I know that your heart is in the very right place. And I have just noticed an irony in this legislation, and it makes me a little bit sad that we have to put something in statute like this. One of the research projects that I had my AP students working on was a topic related to Guantanamo Bay and the issues around torture. That in subdivision 4, prohibition, things are listed here that are in the Geneva Convention, and we are talking about something related to children, and we prohibit this internationally when we take prisoners of war, but we have to put it in statute on how we treat our children, and I find that unsettling and disappointing, but grateful that we spell it out, but for me, that's just a very uncomfortable and sad state. But I can say that recently read that every battered women's shelter in the Twin Cities is full of capacity right now with labor, partly because of what's happening with the foreclosures, with job losses, that families are under stress right now that we have not seen. And we are going to see more children in our schools who are coming to school with depression and with anger and with frustration. And I appreciate deeply that you and Representative Dabney are bringing something forward to help us deal with the stress that our families are going to continue to exhibit. You know, children just do not have the capacity to deal with the stress of what's going on with them. And I am appreciative and also wonderful. So thank you very much for your program.
I had the same response that I was waiting to give you one moment and wondered if I should move to amend the Army Appeal Manual into state statute. But you also, I think, are touching on very much what Representative Downey was talking about. Just yesterday, I emailed to this committee and Representative Crowley's committee members an article from the recent Time magazine on profiling Minneapolis public schools and their challenges with homeless children. At a minimum, 1 in 10 of the children in Minneapolis schools is homeless. 3 kids out of every class is homeless. And the homeless shelters, as with battered women's shelters, are full overflowing. They're seeing increasing numbers of children amongst their numbers. And as Representative Downey said correctly, and the chair reinforced, we're asking. Schools are constantly in the position of dealing with larger issues than reading, writing, arithmetic. And I was pleased to see the chair's offer of the possible creation of a working group to look at the issue of homelessness as one example.
Thank you, members. There are a couple hundred individuals who wish to offer testimony, so I'm going to ask them to come forward. Ms. Amy Roberts with the Department of Education. And then we have Janice Ostrom as well. And I'm wondering if perhaps we should hear from Ms. Ostrom first. Because I suspect that the department also needs some technical things that we may want to go through. So, but let's do that first. Let's ask them. Lori, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And I really appreciate people taking their time and efforts and the efforts that have been made to present this House file.
And I'm sorry, Ms. Ostrom, you'll need this, your name for the record because we recorded the show.
My name is Janice Ostrom.
Ostrom.
And I come to you, I'm a licensed psychologist. I'm also a board certified behavior analyst. I'm a behavioral expert. I have a practice with my business partner, Wendy Selmes. We have a practice that's called Bry Design. Everything we do at Bry Design is in the assessment and analysis of behaviors and behavior change. So I can tell you up front, I very much appreciate what's presented here. I'm going to testify, and I'll be brief. You'll notice some of the frustrations I have, but you'll also notice the passion that I have. Back when Public Law 94-142 was presented, it was required that we provide services to everybody for inappropriate public education. And I appreciate that, and it also includes children who have behavioral disorders and problems. And those problems can be very, very intense. People call me when the behavioral problems are extensive. We're talking about significant physical aggressions towards other children and towards teachers. We're talking about significant property destruction. And we're talking about very significant self-injurious behaviors. When I get called, it's because there's clearly a risk or there has been injury to the child, to the staff. Significant injury. Broken bones. The consideration of very serious threats. So I can tell you that I take the responsibility and the decisions here very seriously. And it's my job. I'd like to just make a few comments for consideration regardless of what's presented here. one of the things that I'm concerned about is that we're no longer wanting to call these interventions the supports we need as interventions. We're going to call them procedures. I very much appreciate that we're going to list them as emergencies, because simply we want to only use these intensive interventions when the safety and imminent harm are presenting risk. So that's why we have the emergencies. We're going to call them under this House file as emergency procedures. And the reason or the intent is that we're going to stay away from interventions, because intervention seems to mean there's a plan. So we'll call them emergencies, and that they will only be used in those instances where people are at risk of harm and injury. And that's actually under our current Minnesota laws. So I appreciate the safety piece. That's absolutely essential. That's where it should be. We'll call them emergencies. However, we also know that there are children who have very significant behavioral profiles, and we recognize that there's going to be a need to plan on emergencies. I'm concerned that most often emergencies are that we don't have a plan, but we're going to plan on emergencies for those children who have very significant behavioral profiles. So I'm just worried about the terminologies that are listed as to how we're labeling these. The other thing I'm worried about is that we're in this House file, and it's under our current laws, is that if the emergencies are used, procedures are used 2 times in a 30-day period, we need to have the teams meet. So the children that I get called to work on is going to mean that teams will meet at least weekly, if not more often, and it's going to be exorbitant in the cost for the schools and for the time allotment for the teams to get together, as well as for the parents to meet with these teams to talk about their behaviors. So I'm very worried about that recording. I'd like to see if there's a way we could revise the need to be able to monitor the frequencies of those behaviors. The other thing that I'm wanting you to notice is that even though we have emergency procedures as outlined here and planned emergencies, those will be outlined on the child IEP as opposed to a plan. In fact, the behavior support plan cannot list out how we're going to intervene. The emergency procedures are going to be acknowledged as part of the IEP, but will not become a part of the behavior plan. That concerns me because I am upfront working with educators and paraprofessionals with some very serious behaviors. We are clearly at risk of getting injured from headbutting, from hitting, from kicking. And so we need to intervene. We need to be very consistent in how we intervene, and we need to be very good about it. We don't have room for error. What we really need is for us to be good about listing it out on methodology in educational record today. It's the behavior plan that is the only document in educational record intended for methodology. But these procedures will be on the IEP. They will not be part of the methodology. I'm concerned about that. That being said, the other thing that I get worried about is that there are some individuals that I've worked with, some children that I work with, whose behaviors are significantly challenging, and it will not meet the criteria for safety or emergency care. We will no longer be able to intervene with those children. For example, when I was working with a child who did engage in the behavior of disrobing himself, taking his clothes off and being naked, we did know that if he took his shoes and socks off, that we could intervene effectively. But taking those clothes off to be naked does not constitute the emergency procedures as defined here. The other concern that I have is that we've got some very unique behaviors that are significantly challenging. Yesterday I met with the consultants at my company. We are clearly talking about how to support a young woman who's engaging in some rectal digging and flinging feces. We need to intervene, but we may not be able to intervene effectively because we don't have the strategies if we pull them all under emergencies. What I'd like you to consider as far as some ideas to throw out here, first, I like the physical holding, which is under subpart 2, or section 2, subpart D, number 4. I would suggest that physically escorting a child from point A to B, it should be considered a restrictive procedure. There are times when we literally need to support a child and it's going to get entangled. If a child goes because we prompt them and we provide a hand on their back and they say, okay, that's fine. But when a child is literally refusing to go and is resulting in some kicking, dropping to the floor and hitting at people, we may need to pull this into a physical escort, which would be considered a physical intervention. So there's the other thing I'd like to consider is having a different way to monitor the frequencies so the costs of making every 2 times these interventions are completed or intervened, that it's not so exorbitant that people will no longer be able to serve these children. I'd like to have that the committee and the people supporting this house file, they clearly do have people with educational expertise and mental health expertise, and I suggest that we could get people with behavioral expertise to work with them. I'd like this house file to enhance more of the functional behavioral assessment. If we don't know the function of the behavior, we can't intervene effectively. The other thing that has increased over the course of time and is currently a problem in a number of the supports for students is the use of police liaison or police officers to address behaviors. And if we no longer have the interventions that are effective and appropriate in supporting students, the frequency of calling the police to intervene will increase significantly. And that's a concern for me, because there's too many children right now that are getting into the juvenile detentions because of police interventions in the schools. I very much appreciate people giving this consideration, and I really appreciate the work that's been done here. And I very much appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ostrom. And without going deeper with this, as the chair, I take your testimony as being encouragement to push you even beyond what's currently on the table here. I think many of the instances that you, I think the many instances of concern that you have raised are scenarios that arise even under current law. And so generally speaking, I think what you're encouraging us is to continue to push ahead, and that there are a few areas here that perhaps need to be, as we continue to push ahead, to be addressed more fully. Any questions? Or if not, thank you. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, were you a part of the group that helped you
analyze what was going on here, or anybody from the organization? Dr.
No.
Representative, any other questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question I'd like to ask, if that's fair here. Doctor, when you look at the present legislation that's in force now, and compare it with this proposed legislation. You have, some advice to us concerning the two?
Representative Olson, I think you did part of that in your presentation.
Yeah,
so you just put
the... I think that in comparison of what's presented here versus what we currently have, there's a lot of similarities. In regards to the emergency procedures, that's under our current rule. What we currently have, though, is that when it's appropriate and it's effective to be intensive, we do have the opportunity to develop behavior support plans with conditional procedures. They need to be closely monitored. And we take that very seriously. We need to see the frequencies of those interventions going down. If they're not, we need to revisit that procedure. That's a change. Under what's proposed here, all of the procedures would be considered traditional, even if we have emergency procedures. Even if we know we're going to intervene for a child with significant self-injurious behaviors or aggressive actions, then we're just going to plan on emergencies. So the emergencies and the plan for emergencies will be listed on the IEP, which is like a blueprint of services. That's very different than when we can list out specifically that when this child does this, staff are to do this. When they do this, we want to do this. I prefer when we're getting intense with aggressive actions and destructive actions and self-injurious behaviors that we have the methodology that people know what to do that increases their consistency. And it'll reduce the injury for the child and it'll reduce the injury for those intervening. This current house file will actually disallow emergency procedures from being described in the plan. It'll pull it into the IEP, but they are not allowed on the behavior support plan. That's a concern for you, and that's one significant difference. Right now, it's current that if we have the emergency procedures, you can only use them 2 times in a 30-day period, and the team has to convene within 5 days. And with the children and the teams that I work with, that in and of itself, that window is talked, that window's not here, so that's fine, but it still requires that the team, including the family, meets after 2 uses within a 30-day period. Some of the children that I work with will meet that within 1 day. It's very difficult for parents and teams to meet at a high frequency. It's cost and time that's going to be a problem. So the option is, where else do these children go?
Ms. Hatton, I'll hold the room. Representative Kagan has a question.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to say parents are really just 2 different things here. If you don't have the emergency laid out in a child's IEP, and this is a new behavior that comes forward, and it comes forward twice in 30 days, then IEPT needs. It doesn't, the IEPT does not need every time that, you know, twice a month. It has nothing to do with that, and there's no limit. And it's just for when, you know, this is really for something, a new behavior that comes out, something new that happens. Otherwise, when you're planning for the emergency, the IEPT decides when they're going to meet again. We should not change that at all. And I wanted to say that one of the reasons we did not include this in the behavior plan is we really wanted to get across that this is not a behavior intervention, it's an emergency intervention. And that it's not just part of a gradual, set of procedures that you do to adjust the behavior. And that was one of the reasons that we did that specifically, because we wanted people to start thinking about this a little bit differently. So I just wanted to clarify those 2 points.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And mine was just a follow-up from some of the testimony and also from the issue of liability. And I haven't looked at or studied this language enough to know.
I'm wondering that if perhaps the Judicial Department, do you have a general question?
No, it's really following on this because it's just a question for any of the folks here. If a teacher has to use an emergency procedure, and it's not spelled out or it doesn't meet the exact criteria here, and that's unexpected, would they be liable then for some damages, et cetera, because they're following this exact procedure or it's not in the plan? Or, in other words, they can use, I guess what I was hearing from you was that we don't have some protection against liability here if we have unexpected circumstances that would require us to use the emergency procedure?
Ms. Solsky. I'm sorry, we go through the chair, so I need to call on you for the record. Dr. Sutton.
Dr.
Davis. You should see what I do at home.
How well do they go?
Mr. Abney goes very well because I always refer to the highest order in my home, and that would be my
You're a wise man.
That girl. Did you have a response to that?
So she said, Mr. Chair, she did say, and I just want to follow up real quickly because, again, as I read this, it says the restrictive procedures are one thing, and somebody may be in the process of doing a restrictive procedure, which becomes an emergency procedure without the IEP or anything else being involved, can you move from one to the other within this language without any liability?
It's
or physical holding, and you leave them in an emergency, and you know, if it's something that you know the child might need in the future, or you've had experience that, you know, you've been using it, and so you're talking, you can include it in the IEP to make sure that you talk about it, it's the same thing.
Like you said, I think, we want to hear from the department. I'm sorry, I almost forgot. Ms. Roberts.
Is that as people have referred to me as a doctor, I wanted to clarify that I'm a licensed psychologist, but I'm a master's level of psychologist, and I'm required to honor to you. Thank you.
Thank you. It is a quirky habit of the chair that everyone that comes forward somehow becomes a doctor at some point. Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Amy Roberts from the Minnesota Department of Education. I too would like to thank Ms. Abercolden and the group that met the summer and fall as well as the work they put into putting this bill together. Having done some drafting in this area, it's a very, very difficult area to incorporate all of the different concepts and needs and requirements that come into play here. So I very much appreciate the effort that they've put forth here. The department has just some concerns with language. There are a few areas where the language is permissive and or vague. And from the department's perspective, from an enforcement perspective, that puts us in a very difficult position of trying to interpret what was meant or what it is we're supposed to be enforcing. And it also sets up some different expectations. Different districts might interpret certain language differently, and we run into the position of conflicting understandings of the language, and that can be difficult for the department. And I think, too, it also puts parents, there's a different understanding on the parent side, and so, again, we're stuck in this interpretation quagmire. But we are working through the language, and I think we would be able to come up with some suggestions that we would like to present to the author. We have not finished that review, but I anticipate that we'd be able to get some clarifying language.
Thank you for that, Ms. Roberts and Representative Danny. I suspect that you are open to those suggestions from the department. Obviously, this is a product that comes from a very carefully worked out collaborative process, and so there may be a little bit of time issues with that, but we are going to lay this over today. It'll be back before us next week, and hopefully that will give us time to be able to arrive at an acceptable and good way to address the department's concerns in that regard. So I'm just looking for you for confirmation that you're engaged in that process in the next few days.
The department and I just nodded.
Nodding is good.
Nodding.
Very well. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on the bill? Are there any further questions or observations from committee members? If not, then, I'm sorry. Will someone else come forward? Please come forward. Gloria, sir.
Hi. This is my first opportunity to come up here and talk. My name is Richard Heller, for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Heller.
I was just going through this document. I have a problem with reading, but if you can follow along real quick here, you want that one, I hope. And two questions. First of all, on 2-1, talks about timeout. My son has been in a timeout room setting. He said he had a big window in it, but I never really got to look at the room. But it asked a few specific questions about that. One of them would be like, down on 3.35 talks in that area on the
ID, whatever that is. Yes. Talks about tamper-proof fixtures, electrical switches, and then located immediately outside the door and secured ceilings. My question was, is electrical switches and electrical plugs inside the room?
I don't know.
And another one about secured ceilings. I don't know if they're reachable. I don't know what a secured ceiling is. Other than that, another one I was going to talk about, I wasn't quite able to find it, but I agree with that one lady that was up here earlier. I can't remember her name. But anyhow, she talked about functional behavior assessments and IEPs, and it concerns me, does the team know, or do these people that are working with these kids know what's on an IEP versus a functional behavior assessment? Again, they interface with one another, but when they're working with them, it's important that they know that data sort of transfers. That's another piece of that.
Why don't we try to answer those questions quickly before we forget and perhaps just have your whole internal and respond. So there's two series of questions here. One, first one related to timeout rooms and the ceiling issue and the electrical switches and fixtures either inside or outside the room. And then we've got the second question of the interconnect between the
Saturday. In the timeout room, you wouldn't have the plugging stuff in the room because that would be dangerous.
I'm sorry. I'm going to need to slide the mic over to you because we are recording this. So we'll need to pause that back and forth. Why don't you begin again,
Mr. Chairman, members. The timeout room, you can't have that kind of stuff inside the room because that could become dangerous to a child who's out of control. And the ceiling issue, what we wanted to make sure is that it was a secure ceiling so a child couldn't, you know, grab down the part of the ceiling tile or something like that and then use it to injure herself. On the functional behavior assessment, we are professionals who know how to do that and that feeds into what would be in any type of behavior plan and that would be a key part, obviously, in children with these type of behaviors. And I'd be happy to, talk with you at the hearing and answer any questions that you have.
Wonderful. Mr. Allen, you did have another question, I believe.
Yeah, just a comment on that. I don't know if the ceilings are reachable if the kid's up on the chair. I don't know if they include that process, but something else to consider. I don't know if the chairs are supposed to be secured down. Because, again, it doesn't say electrical plugs. It just says fixtures secure. I don't know what that means. That might mean that's all. The last thing, talks about number 511, talks about thresholds. I'm not sure, I guess because I don't know enough about all the above, what all these thresholds are. I guess I don't know who determines thresholds. Is that an IB team decision? I'm sure it partially is, but again, what is a threshold?
Ms. Sadler.
There's a lot of programs out there that kind of teach people to do these things. A threshold can mean something doing physical holding. There's a threshold down that you don't want to go because people lose health and height and things like that. So, and it's a little state of the art in terms of them.
Thank you. Is the threshold is established by each individual or by a procedure that the district has to draw?
Mr. Chairman, I'd really like Dr. Rick Amato to answer that question because he knows that that's much better than I do.
Dr. Rick Amato, would you
mind
to come forward? Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Rick Amato. I have a PhD in educational psychology. I'm a licensed psychologist. I've been practicing in areas of applied behavior analysis for over 35 years. When we talk about applying thresholds to an individual, identifying specific criteria which for that individual, when met, would initiate a change in the procedure, process, or activity. Those thresholds should be established as part of determining in an IEP meeting or a planning meeting which procedures might be used and which procedures should not be used for a particular child. If you look at, can I elaborate a little bit? Do you have a few minutes?
You're doing fine, Dr. Amato. I can refer to you as Dr. Amato.
Yes, you can. If you look at the CPSS regulations on medical assistance for working with children, there's a specific requirement in there to discuss what to do in case of an emergency. It's similar language to what's being employed in this act, in this bill. And what that means is that you, in the team meeting, you say, well, if all these things don't work and we have a breakdown, what will we do? And that's where you start to talk about alternative procedures, including the ones referenced in the act. You would identify which procedures should not be used with a child. For example, is that the woman referred to someone with asthma? There's something that do not do with someone with asthma. There are people who've had traumatic, psychological traumatic incidents in the history, so things you do not do with those children as well. And so that's an opportunity to exclude procedures and also look at, well, if we do run into an emergency, if the COVID plan doesn't work, if it all fails and breaks down, what can we do? And that's where you would describe what can be done, and you would identify thresholds for implementation, thresholds for change, thresholds for calling in assistance, and so on.
Well, thank you.
Thank
you, Dr. Mara. Mr. Eller, there are great questions. I appreciate you.
Thank you. I'd ask for consideration then if thresholds are something by this DCTS, that when these things come up, that parents presented with a list, because not all parents are knowledgeable, perhaps, since there are thresholds and it doesn't really spell it out in here, maybe it would be helpful for parents, so when it comes to looking at a statute, that at least, you know, they got a reference, because we're all winging it, you know. But this is pretty heavy-based, evidence-based science, typically what do you call it, right? So I'm just trying to keep a pattern of fidelity again. If there's something that, again, that districts can share among themselves with this group here, CCPS or something, maybe that's something you can develop into this. Thank you.
Thank you. I think it's a great suggestion. It's something I do want to look at the language to see if there's further ways to empower parents with necessary information and interventions that can then complement, the work that's happening in the school setting with their children. Thank you, Ms. Jelly. Representative Davy, I think we're ready here to lay this on the table. Any final words before
I just appreciate both the work that has been done previous to this and the successful conversation and exploration of these issues today.
I look forward, Representative Abney, to the product as it continues to move forward next week when we reconsider this bill. Members, House File 1621 will be laid over, as amendment will be laid over for possible inclusion in the K-12 policy on the list.
What's going on?
I just didn't know what to do. I'll call 1701, Representative. Good morning, Representative.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newton was moved to House File 1701 and recommended to pass, and we're also looking to hear this bill today and then wait over for possible inclusion in the K-12 Communist Policy Bill.
That's right.
Representative Newton, do you have an amendment to?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have H-1701-DD2 amendment.
Very well. Representative Newton, having moved House File 1701, now moves the DE2 amendment. It's a delete everything amendment. And this will put the bill in shape the author wishes it to be before the committee at this time. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails. House File 1701 is amended as reports.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we start going through the bill, I really want to thank Jason Larson and Shannon Patrick for the incredible work that they've done. This was a very good group to work with, a lot of ideas, not always consensus, and of course when we have some staff, we're able to pull things together and work with us very well. Mr. Chair, this morning with me I have Peter Martin and Grace Keller from MSTA, and David Wilson, or Mr. Martin.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Martin. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Peter Martin, on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association. Mr. Chair, I'd like to just say a couple of highlights. First of all, in this delete all, the changes that are reflected here, the additions and strikeouts were reviewed over a series of meetings in the past 3 weeks or so, and there is, a widespread agreement among the meetings, I should say, were between the representatives of the advocacy community and also schools, and I think to a very significant degree, there was a consensus, if I may use the word, to the changes set forth in this particular document. And so,
Mr. Martin, I'm going to interrupt, and I apologize for that. We are picking up some static. You guys can hear that. I'm told that if we turn off our cell phones, that greatly helps. So I turned mine off and put it in front of me to make sure that get to turn it back on when I leave the room. So if I could ask people in the audience, or in the room rather, if they could turn off your cell phones, I think it'll help with some of the static. This not only potentially could bother us, but can actually interfere with having this hearing properly recorded. So appreciate your help with that. I'm sorry, Mr. Martin, please proceed.
Yes, sir. There was several meetings between the advocacy community, representatives of this body, and the schools to see what we could do about the special education statutes and rules in Minnesota. And what really has guided, I think, the changes here are several components, including a recognized need of redundancy or the presence of redundancy between state law and federal law. We've got federal law and state law in some cases saying the same thing. We tried to eliminate the redundancy. We have tried to eliminate some conflicts between state and federal law in terms of special education process and procedure. And we also, in some respects, tried to consolidate what we thought was repetition between a state rule that was also addressed in a state statute. And so I think that was the largely motivation here with respect to these amendments. Let me quickly go through the subdivisions, starting in the first case, Section 125A02, Child with a Disability Defined. Basically, two concepts here. A child with a disability, the definition has been aligned or some language modifications have been included in there to recognize the federal definition of child with a disability. A child has a disability and by reason thereof needs special education. And below that, their reference to standards of the commissioner has changed the rule to clarify to the public that if there is a standard out there, it's a rule and not something else. And that change is also reflected in subdivision 1A below that, and then in subdivision 2 at the bottom of page 1. Over on page 2, section 125.807, regarding rulemaking, there are some revisions here motivated, I think, and animated by the work of the two task force that recognized that there was a significant amount of rules and statutes that already existed in Minnesota with respect to special education. I believe 60 to 70 statutes, not including a definition section with 40 subparts. And so we thought it was necessary to clarify and redefine the rulemaking authority of the department and place some parameters on that rulemaking authority, including that we would generally only want the department to make rules if they were specifically required by federal law. Specifically authorized by this body, the legislature.
Yes, indeed. We are state legislature.
Yes. On page 3, a couple of changes here at subsection A. Basically, the IEP of a child shall be in effect at the beginning of the school year. This is a federal concept that we are incorporating in state law. And then there was a change made regarding transition obligations to kind of a compromise position between the current law and what is provided in federal law, which is age 16. Basically calls for the transition planning commencing during the child's ninth grade year. There are no changes, I believe, other than some technical change.
Mr. Martin, I do have a question. Members, it probably would be good to raise questions as we go through, because these are different issues that we're addressing as we walk through the bill. So, Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, just to that point about the grade 9 compromise, wouldn't there be situations where we have students, especially students with certain disabilities, that are never actually going to achieve the grade 9 status along the way? And so I always thought that was the reason for the age 14, is that as your life progresses or where you would be in grade 9, we're going to do that evaluation just the same. Comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Representative,
yeah, thank you, Representative. I don't know of a case where children are held back disability. You have accommodations, but they continue through school as any other child. So maybe someone else in the room might know, but I've never heard of that. I don't know if just Representative Peterson is familiar with that.
Ms.
Abner-Holden,
I think, wants to weigh in as well.
These are our child with a serious disability. I mean, they do go to high school. So, you know, the intent of this was, you know, at age 14, you might still be in middle school. And so the compromise was, we really should focus those energies and those resources when a child hits high school. You know, they might spend to really push it that way. So there was no intent to try to.
Right here,
no intent to try to
move
around that, so that you can deny that
transition
service for that
child. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. Mr. Martin.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Continuing then on page 5, the remainder of the revisions, the statutory revisions, primarily reside within the due process hearing an alternative dispute resolution statute. So a number of changes within a single statutory section. Starting at the top of page 5, this is one of the things I just mentioned briefly before. There's a recognition by parties who review current law that there's a lot of redundancy between federal and state law, and the deletions indicated here are a reflection of the parties' agreement that there is redundancy. Continuing then on page 6, there is no changes here other than technical changes. Page 7, once again, on mediated agreements, the language that's inserted is federal language. We do have federal standards governing mediated agreements and mediation process, and this language is designed to conform to federal standards. Below, on the bottom of page 7, the inserted language there is one of those efforts to consolidate the concept that currently exists in a state rule, and this language was inserted in the state statute, and we are proposing the repeal of the rule in which it's located so that there's no repetitiveness. The deletion at the bottom is just a reflection that it kind of states an obvious proposition, and so we decided to eliminate the superfluous language. On the top of page 8, on hearing officer qualifications, one of the things that came out in the reauthorization of the federal special ed law is some new parameters for hearing officer qualifications. Those are reflected here. There was an amendment to that to reflect that hearing officers could not be employed by or contract with the department or the school district except if the contract is to appoint the person as a hearing officer. At the bottom of page 8, starting at 8.30, this language was stricken because it did not conform to current federal standards with regard to the process of requesting a hearing. And the language on page 9, the insert language that follows, is a reflection of the current federal procedure regarding the requesting of a special education due process hearing or an administrative hearing. Going over to page 10, We see at the top there the continuation of the explanation of the procedures under federal law for requesting a hearing. Towards the lower middle of the page, subdivision 16 regarding burden of proof, this is a reflection of the federal Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals decision in MM versus Special School District Number 1. The Eighth Circuit has said, notwithstanding the state statute, that the burden of proof is on the party seeking relief, that this changes to conform to the federal court's decision. On page 11, on subdivision, excuse me, the lines 11-13 to 11-16, again, an effort to consolidate rule and statute. There are some administrative rules that govern the process of a due process hearing, and we simply took some concepts from those rules, added it to the statute regarding hearing officer authority, and so to eliminate some repetitiveness. Subdivision 19 on page 11 is the revisions reflected there are intended to adopt and conform to the federal process for conducting an expedited due process hearing. And then continuing then on page 12, the changes reflected there are to avoid repetition of lines 12.3 to 12.7 are reflected, as I said, in the prior portion of the statute. And then the language set forth therein, the insert language, is a compilation of a concept from a Minnesota rule on the subject regarding the hearing officer's decision. And then the language regarding the hearing officer's ability to order compliance with procedural safeguards, that is current federal law. It has been inserted into the federal statute. At the bottom of page 12, starting at line 12.27, the language was stricken. It viewed as redundant of the federal state put provision, and so the decision and determination was that we would simply follow the federal standard. At the top of page 13, same thing. The people felt that it was redundant, or in some cases in excess of federal law, and we wanted to come back to the federal standard. There's some technical changes on subdivision 25. And 27, that change was requested by the department. And then the district liability piece is a clarification that the so-called harmless error standard is applicable in both special education due process hearings and state complaints. And we were just trying to make sure that there was one substantive standard for assessing whether appropriate services are being provided, that there was one standard that was applicable to both dispute resolution processes. And then at the bottom of the page 13, the assistive technology definition has been revised to simply reflect the federal special education definition of assistive technology, which excludes surgically implanted devices. And then there is a repealer going up page 13 to the top of page 14, that you're eliminating some statutes that are reviewed to be in excess of federal law or outdated language that needed to be repealed. And then also some administrative rules were also recommended for repeal. So definitions in particular, I think the definition of parent in the special ed rules was removed. And I think this is a very positive thing. Going with the federal definition of parent makes it easier to identify a parent for purposes of educational decision making for a child, and that's very, very significant for both parents and schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. And members, I always forget this, but the repeal language you'll find in the original draft. Although I think it's kind of close to all of them, is that correct? So we'll have to either encourage members to look those statutes up, and we'll have to print them out for you so you can have them before you. Very well. Ms. Callagher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman. My name is Grace Kelleher. I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. And before I get too much farther, I want to recognize Representative Mutant's work on this. Special education law, at least here at the Capitol for my 10 years up here, has not really been much changed or updated. And it was in desperate need. But as you can tell by the subject of the mixed release, despite care this language takes, it takes a real special person to help you do that. Representative Newton, after all our meetings, was there, helped us through it, moved us along, and really got something which I feel is very significant for Minnesota schools. And we can talk about a lot of reform issues. I think you're looking at a bill that really does some good reform for schools, parents, and kids. And I just want to compliment him that he's been a pleasure to work with. Also, the advocate community has been wonderful. They came to the table ready to work well officially and take concepts from the task force, which are just sort of general ideas, and actually translate that to law. I also want to thank Shannon and Lisa Larson for all their hard work. They really had to, in the end, make it work. And Lisa especially had an astounding effort to see this in front of you. So it may not look big and it may not look significant, but folks, I can guarantee you this is huge for your schools at home, and you all should have pride when you look at this bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your efforts. And stick to it as well. Let's get some testimony from the public as well. Anyone else who wishes to testify, please make your way forward. I do have a list of testifiers. I'll start with those. First, Ms. Abdul, you're at the table, so I'm going to get to you. And then we have Dr. Gibbons from and
Ms.
Sandy Roberts from the Department of Education.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Kim Gibbons. I'm currently the Executive Director at the St. Croix River Education District, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, MACE. And I'll just keep my comments brief. I just wanted to say that MACE supports the proposed bill, as we believe that the new language really eliminates some redundancies, some duplicity, helps align state and federal language. In addition, we really believe that the proposed language provides needed clarification in the area of alternative dispute resolution and due process hearings. And we really believe that this will be beneficial for all of the school districts and the special ed directors around the state that are interpreting this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Gibbons.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon, Ms. County, Minnesota. I just want to also thank Representative Newton and Shannon and Lisa for their incredible work. And it was interesting to work that many hours with the folks from MSBA. And I do want to thank the other advocacy organizations, PACER, ARC, and the Disability Law Center. It was a real hard negotiation, but I think we did reach some good agreements and some good compromises. There are some other things that we're continuing to work on, and perhaps with a little more chocolate we can get it done more quickly. Particularly on discipline and some other due process issues that we just kind of ran out of time in terms of hammering out language, but we agreed conceptually to some things. So I think we support the bill, and we'll continue to work on some issues before the kind of final day for the bill. But I want to, again, thank everyone for working together on this.
Thank you, Ms. Senator. Ms. Roberts. Well, good. I was hoping I got to say good morning to your friend, the commissioner, who some members may not know, has a long and honorable history related to these very difficult issues, including the more difficult ones that we dealt with earlier in the bill. And so we appreciate your leadership over the years. In regards to these issues, and little by little we get there, don't we? Well, good morning.
Mr. Chair, member Danny Roberts of the Department of Education. There's the one repeal that we do have some substantive changes, and I do want to address that in the public. That is the one where we are now
and members, I do apologize, although it's not always customary, I think it is helpful for committee members to have the language before them. I often read these bills and I'll just see these numbers and, you know, what are we talking about here? It's easy to forget to look them over very quickly, so I appreciate you pointing these out to us. So, Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, members, Minnesota Statute 125A.18 deals with shared time services. So this largely affects students who attend non-public institutions for education and all sorts of other like shared time opportunities that exist. Currently, under Minnesota law, Minnesota entitles students who attend non-public schools basically full special education services. That doesn't necessarily mean the services are provided at the private school, but it means that a student enrolled in a non-public school would have the opportunity to access special education services from their resident district. The federal law scheme, if you will, or the way the federal law serves non-public students is not full service, but instead is a proportionate share. So it is basically a ratio or it's based on sort of total population compared to special education, or total special education population compared to non-public student population. And then the resources are sort of divvied out according to that ratio, and when the resources run out, the resources run out. Minnesota historically has not taken a proportionate share perspective, but has instead provided full service to all special education children, regardless of what type of educational institution they have. So repealing this particular statute would impact that level of service that's provided. With respect to the other portions of the bill, the department supports all of the changes that are presented in the bill and agrees that it will clear up many confusing or conflicting pieces of Minnesota statute versus federal law and or remove redundancies.
Ms. Roberts, how many students roughly would we be talking about as affected by this proposed change? And we can come back to it as well, because we're not going to move this bill today.
Mr. Chair, I think we're talking about 15% of the student population.
Mr. Chair and members,
12,000. Commissioner.
Not the only reason, but I think the philosophy of our state has been that we try to serve our children as a community. So regardless of whether a child is in public or private school, all of our children are precious to us. And particularly when you have a child with a special need. And I think we've had a long tradition in our state of trying to serve all of those children. This will impact our private school students and those families who, for one reason or another, have chosen a private school setting for their child, but who have a special need. Now we can look at this as they should come back into the public school system and be served, and we can take that attitude. But I have, as commissioner, always tried to look at working with all of the different communities of education and trying to serve them as best we can. I know that these are tight fiscal times, so we're trying to pinch every penny that we can out of our system. But I would ask that you reconsider this. You'll have 12,000 students that will not get the kind of services that they will need, whether they're in private or public school. And that has not been a tradition that we've had in the state of Minnesota. It is your choice, but I had to express that as Commissioner of Education. And personally, from my perspective, is working in special education, supporting students with special needs for a long time. It's not to point fingers at any of you to say that your decision is bad or wrong, but it is just to consider very thoughtfully that all these children deserve to have that support. And would hope that you would consider that. otherwise still strange.
The members, you know, and just so you know, in many ways, because we were involving collaboratively quite a number of people, the bill as amended comes before us as a result of the long process of doing that. We don't have the 125.8.18 repealer in the bill as introduced. Which means that the general public doesn't know that at this point. And so all the more reason for us not to move this bill than make sure that the general public is full aware of all the things that are being proposed before us. And so we won't be moving this bill today. We'll have certainly another full opportunity to continue to address this and other issues in the bill. But so you, I think you wanted to make a comment. I think I've already said Donnie has a question as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, by fully providing this service for non-public school kids, we have to remember that our special ed funding is woefully inadequate. It means that we're taking money out of the general fund to fund special ed kids in non-public schools. And I, you know, we can look at this again. This isn't over again. But I just want to make sure that we get all of the interest groups to look at this. And by repealing the statute, it makes a very significant savings for school districts, both time and funding. So.
Commissioner Sigler.
I think that what you will see is maybe not savings. You may see these students move back into the public school system, which will be a larger cost in the future, because not only will you be spending your money on your specialized portion, but you will also be spending on the generalized portion too. So I think you have to kind of balance out, you know, what maybe the ramifications. And beyond that, I appreciate what you all are trying to do. I know you're trying to look at cost savings. I know I was on the school board. I know we faced the special education cost issue all the time, and it is significant. But I would just ask that you think about that as we go forward.
Thank you, Representative Falls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I assume for the commissioner, is in a private school system, what do the special ed teachers have to have the same requirements, the licensure requirements, the same training requirements as they do in the public school system, or is it different?
Commissioner
Mr. Chair and Representative Falls, generally the special education services are delivered by the resident district, so the student is generally transported to the school district and they receive their services by a fully licensed special education teacher that is in the
system. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I caught the word usually. So the requirement is not that they have to do that requirement. So the requirements are not there for the public, the private school to have to do that. They don't have to do.
The private school licensure, there is no licensure under the private school. So if a parent chooses to have all of their education provided at the private school, it would be by the private school according to how the private school runs their operation.
I don't know if we have additional testifiers.
I'm seeing signals from the audience of folks that may want to weigh in. I suspect under 125.8.18, Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I just want to reinforce that this is public school dollars that you pass through the formula on HSA, that we then have to prorate out of our general fund to cover the special education classes in public schools, that we're giving 100% coverage because if they go to a public school, and there's just kind of, there's just
with private schools are reimbursement for special education funding. Just because we removed the law doesn't mean we removed the piece that would work with their private schools and public schools and have agreements with all of them. But I truly believe that the inherent currency, if in fact you're going to cap and not cover 100% of public schools special education funding, somehow it doesn't seem fair that we would do it and come and make a choice to go to a private school. And there they can come and protect the
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Anyone else on this point?
Mr. Chair, how our discussion is the disagreement and a lot of issues.
As I said, this is an issue that has been debated in many ways several times over the past few years, and we continue to discuss this issue, and I suspect we'll continue to do it for quite a while after this year. Members, and any other questions or thoughts? Anyone else in the audience wishes to testify on the common bill? Mr. Allen, please come forward. Welcome back, Mr. Allen.
Mr. Heller regularly attended our school board meetings in Anoka, Hennepin, and Anoka, along
that. In Anoka, Hennepin, Perry. Very good. Mr. Heller, I'm sorry, I think I've been mispronouncing your name.
That's okay, I can't even say it right a lot of times. So. I appreciate the time again here. This is Rick Heller on Bill 1701. I struggle with reading, so to get this document the same day is tough on me.
Good.
You can bear along with me. I like to dive into just going back to this paperwork. If we could go on to 1.10, talks about deaf, blind, disability there. I was studying about this because my son was found with a PRIC disability. PRIC disability is an organic disorder, and all it falls under is called a reading disorder. I ask that you would consider a PRIC disability would be somehow part of that. PRIC disability is really important because what that does is, perhaps somebody can correct me, it's called NIMHS, and I believe it was 2006, they are to turn books over to become digitized. I think that's when the state sent out a memo on it, I believe. And what happens is, because they make it more or less readable on a computer, they get readers that help kids access what they can. For instance, the only way I can read is with a PDF. I can't read, but I'm glad there's PDFs, because I can do nouns or any specific word. As you know, you'll all probably use it yourself in these huge documents. I just ask you to consider and put that in there, because there's some rules you could write these down. These are federal rules that were introduced in, I believe, who knows when, without a rights law. Anyways, if you write these down and look that up, see if it's applicable here. It's 20... USC, that's United States Code, correct? 1474 D2A. Another one, same one, but it's E2B. You'll find print disability in there. You'll also find print disability in 300.72 B2 and then B23. Again, it's all about kids being able to access print. It's important for functional reasons and academic, that they can access these texts. As you all know, NWA or MAP testing, which is one of the pieces the state is considering to use triangulation with the MCAs for growth models. On the NWA testing, there's a formula that comes out of that called Lexiles. Lexiles are readability formula based on two components, length of sentence and frequency of a word.
every kid gets a readability component out of that beta range. I could show my kid hasn't changed for 3 years in that specific area regarding that lexile number with compared to MCA, he's continuing to go down the 3-year trend map. Again, I can show it's frozen. Anybody's welcome to it. Call me up. I'll be glad to sit down and show you this data. We all know the state of Minnesota was involved in a Perkins grant from this legislature from the University of Minnesota. It's called CAREI, C-A-R-E-I. About $3 million spent in Okehannepin to see what was going on because they had a discrepancy between MAP levels and MCA levels. That was one of the flags that triggered that, and they specifically took elementary schools. Again, there's a gap growth level between MCAs and MAP testing. My kid shows it. He shows some growth on MAP testing, as we all know is an instructional test. But as the MCA tools, we know that's an independent test. You have to know it. Again, I ask you to consider that. Again, this goes all back into the print disability. I'm all over the place. I know I am. But I'd like to sit down and talk to you about that.
Mr. Heller, it's too bad it wasn't bright enough here to hear your testimony on this issue. Members, we, Mr. Heller, we are going to have to move along very, very fast here, just a couple more minutes, because we do have two other bills, including the private policy bill that we need to work forward. I do want to, however, for members, acknowledge the incredible power and presence of a both a caring and well-informed parent. Apparently you are, Mr. Heller, and I think that's precisely the kind of dynamics that we want to be able to encourage in these things, to have more empowered and knowledgeable parents engaging in policy issues as it pertains to how we can do a much better job with our children. Mr. Hart, you want to respond to something?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify that the print disorder that was Mr. Heller referenced is considered a reading disorder, and we, I just wanted to clarify for the chair that reading disorders could fall under the definition as could fall under the definition of specific learning disability that's set forth at 1.9 of the language there. So it could be criteria that be addressed.
Very well. Very quickly then, Mr. Heller, because we are going to move along.
Thank you again, Commission. Just so we know, word blindness. I can't spell. I can't spell but past the third grade level. But thanks to the computer and I can access it. That goes back into this technology piece again. And the functional piece and how important that is. That it's recognized in there as well, what it does, what this print disability and how it plays a role. Kids need to, it's one thing you can't spell, because you got to get the words in your head and you got to get to memorize them. And then you finally hook the dots together. Mm-hmm. And, LD is really broad, but let me say this. Print disability is more specific to organic. You study Chaiowitz's material, organic, is you actually have a hole in one side of your head, left hemisphere, the three processors, the middle one turns off. So what do you do? You rewire yourself. Everything usually being processed on the right hemisphere. Again, more specific. It's important to be specific because when you start doing interventions, and evidence-based, and to know about the difference between a reading disorder and LD is so broad, can't stress it enough. You can do what you want. You're the chair, so.
It's great advice that as our research knowledge advances, we need to consistently go back to our policies and make sure that they're keeping pace with the knowledge of what's being produced out of that research. Representative Newton, I think we're, thank you, Mr. Heller. Thank you, Mr. Barton. I think we're ready. Any final words here? I suspect, like the representative Jackson, there may be some work that might be happening.
This is a work in progress, Mr. Chair, and we're going to continue to work on it to further refine the bill and and to make special education legislation something that's easy to comprehend and hopefully easier for the school districts to comply.
So, Newton, I think it's fine work that you've done here and the collaborative committee that's come together to work on this. With that, House Bill 1701 as amended, final possible inclusion in the 212 Omnibus Policy Bill. Members, House Bill 553, Representative Beecher. Representative Beecher rules that House Bill 553 be recommended to pass. And in 10 years to lay over for possible inclusion next week in the Omnibus Policy Bill. And Representative Dietrich, you have a DB1 amendment?
Yes, sure.
Representative Dietrich moves the DB1 amendment. Members, it's a stability shape with your mission, and that should be as well.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The DB1 amendment. Hearing calls almost words for word closer to what the governor and the department is going to present today on online learning, and it also then the language that they use. And so I thought it was actually going to get us a lot further if we went with the D1 amendment and we could work from there. And I just want to make a final Mr. Martin has also already talked to me about some of the wordage type of things in the bill that might be more helpful for the application and interpretation of the DP1 amendment. So, with that, Mr. Chairman, he told you that he realized you are carrying the governor's bill.
Yes, and Representative Mitchell, let's go ahead and move act on the amendment that we'll get into the rest of the question over here. All in favor of the D1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is now before us the way in which you wish to have it before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Congress, like this today, in order to have some sort of overview and history about online learning in your state, and then we realize that the piece of legislation is in the governor's bill, and the department will be probably talking to it briefly. But we thought that it would be nice to highlight and draw attention of the delivery system of online learning today. Once again, this is a preview to the governor's bill, or at least one piece of the governor's bill. But I must say that as I researched online learning in the state, I realized that I, as a policymaker, knew very little and not enough about online learning in the state. And so through this process, I have learned more, and I hope that that is something that will come out of here today, is that all of us will know a little bit more about online learning. Because, you know, one thing is that there is great growth in interest in the area of online learning in the state. The other thing is that I want to just make a point that I think that sometimes there's a lot of misconceptions about online learning. We think that it takes the place of the teacher, or that it's going to make learning cold, hard, and unthinking for some of us. But I hope that this year will also add some clarity and some comfort to this issue. So in order to make the best use of our time today, I will provide a brief history on online learning. Mr. Boss from the Intermediate School District over 287 will walk through the changes in the bill so you can feel comfortable with the changes and the wording. And then Superintendent Don Lyman will give us a picture of how online learning actually functions in the International Health School District. So with that, would you share a little bit about the history? In 2003, the Online Learning Options Act opened up access for online learning enrollment for all students into any online learning program in the state. There were a variety of programs that grew out of that act, providing a multitude of new opportunities for students in the need for an alternative delivery. And one of the most meaningful features of that, of this whole online learning act for me, was learning what kind of students actually access, or I would actually say need, online learning options right now. So I just want to mention a few of them. For example, gifted students seeking credit advancements that can't be offered in their own school district. Athletes or artists whose rigorous practice schedule requires them to be out of the classroom or out of the school for long periods of time.
seems a full-time job who needs to work to help finance their family's economics. Students with medical issues, pregnant teens, or teen parents. Students who have been expelled from that local school or school district. Students in treatment centers. Former dropouts, including a high school diploma. Students seeking credit recovery so that they can get catch up to the rest of their class. Students with psychological issues that are function that have a very difficult time functioning in our traditional setting. Students having difficulty achieving the goals of NCLE. Well, as I mentioned, in 2003, the Learning Act opened up lots of options, and this had a number of conflicts also involved in the new law as students enrolled in online learning classes, and then they had to transfer those credits back to their home school or school district. In 2007, Senator Sackhoff and Representative Ann Bell worked to modify the language. Unfortunately, the interpretation and the implementation was a little bit more cumbersome than expected. The result had a great deal of bureaucratic paperwork, taking literally hundreds of hours of staff time in the verification process of an online learning class. So, what we are trying to do here today is to help improve communication, help clarify these ugly transitions and online learning back to the classroom. And with impact. So with that, I will ask Mr. Voss if you would talk a little bit about the bill.
Morning, Mr. Voss. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Finney, and thank you, Representative Dietrich, for bringing this forward for us. We have seen 50 to 80% growth in interest and enrollment in online learning since 2003, when the Online Learning Options Act was introduced. There are now about 20 online learning providers that are approved by the Department of Education. And there are projections that up to 50% of student learning could be taking place through online opportunities in the next 5 to 10 years. And so this is a growing interest in school districts and among students and parents. Our intent here was to improve the clarity, consistency, and communication between the providers and the local schools in order to increase the student achievement levels, particularly in the area of supplemental online learning. And so I'll just walk through some of the changes. First of all, in section one or number 1.7 and 1.8, the intent there is to clarify that the enrollment procedures that we're looking at apply specifically to supplemental online learning. There was a clarification of the definition between full-time and supplemental in 2007, and the idea is that full-time online learning programs generally operate under open enrollment statute. So students open enroll into a full-time online learning program and become the responsibility of that school district or charter school. In supplemental online learning, the student remains enrolled in their local district, takes one or two courses, or if the district approves more than that, through an online learning provider, and then transfers the credit back. And that's the situation where there's a little bit more clarity and consistency required, and especially communication between the local district and the online provider, so that students are taking courses that they need to graduate and are successful in those. Starting in line 1.20 and onward there, in regards to this application process then, we would like to provide a consistent means of informing the enrolling district of the course content and expectations. And so we're asking that the online learning providers make available to the enrolling district the course syllabus in a format established by the commissioner. There are some specific items here that are intended to be in that syllabus so that the local school district knows how the online provider is meeting those requirements. We also would like to establish a timeline in which the enrolling district replies and ensure that the courses are reviewed to meet the graduation requirements of the enrolling district. And so starting in line 2.3 and onward, we're asking that within 15 days after the online learning provider makes information available to the enrolling district, that that district will confirm or deny that those courses meet the student's graduation requirements. We would also like to ensure that online courses are accepted if they meet corresponding graduation requirements and are not denied without cause. And so in line 2.7 and onward, we've asked that an online learning course that meets the graduation requirements at the enrolling district would be considered to meet the corresponding graduation requirements there. The state graduation requirements, you should also meet the length of graduation requirements among their specific additional things that local districts require. We have also asked, included that there is consistency in the reporting of student progress so that the enrolling district is fully aware of students that are not meeting requirements. And that's in number 2.23, section F, that the online provider would report student progress in a manner specified by the commissioner, unless there is another manner previously agreed upon by the district and the provider. When dealing with 20 different providers, some schools have indicated that dealing with 20 different systems of reporting is something of a nightmare. So we are thinking that if there is a consistent way to report that student progress is agreed upon by both parties, and we want to make sure that there is at least a minimum standard expected. In addition to that, we are asking that the enrolling district designate a contact person to assist in the facilitation and monitoring of student progress. This is to establish a role for the enrolling district in assigning responsibilities for monitoring student progress and to involve them in the whole process of making sure that the student is successful. On page 4, at number 4.1, we did want to emphasize and clarify the intent of the original Online Learning Options Act that full-time programs must also be certified by the Department of Education. There was some uncertainty as to whether a full-time program could be considered to be providing online learning to its own enrolled students and therefore not subject to these requirements, but I believe the understanding expectation is that a full-time online program does need them as much or more so than a supplemental program. And then finally, in subdivision 7, and this speaks to the impact of some of the changes that were made in 2007 in regards to the demonstration of alignment standards. We'd like to establish the syllabus as the primary means of communicating course information rather than the overwhelming detail that resulted from the standards alignment process. This requires a pickup truck to deliver the boxes of information to the Department of Ed. In the standard alignments process, that information was not particularly helpful to the local district or the students or the parents. And so the changes starting in 4.20, eliminating the language on demonstration of alignment to standards, and instead shifting it to a syllabus that includes not only information about the standards alignment, but additional information on all of the other pieces of online learning that help students be successful would be much more useful to the local district in making a decision whether a course meets a student's graduation plan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Superintendent Wiley, good to see you again. I saw you, I was up on the range. Almost a year ago, I think.
Yes, you were, Mr. Chair, and we look forward to having you come back.
Wonderful to be here.
Chair, committee, I'd also like to extend my appreciation, as it's already been done by Dr. Haas, for supporting the leadership of the this has been somewhat of a process, to say the very least. And I would just like to express to your committee, Mr. Chair, what House File 553 represents to a superintendent of schools who has been very involved with the online learning development phenomenon in Minnesota. I hope always as a colleague, not always as a proponent or an opponent. What this bill represents is a status that I think is absolutely imperative for public schools in Minnesota. And as an example, perhaps, of how public policy, if allowed to have its dynamic, will help and come to a conclusion that I think is for the good of everybody. When online learning first came in, I took the same position as I suppose about 300 and some of my colleagues. Here comes another one. We lost some ADMs to open enrollment, we lost ADMs to the SEO, we lost ADMs to charter schools, and now here comes online, and I'm not even going to have any risks left to even worry about tomorrow. And I think the attitude we took, was denial, adversarial. As one of my colleagues correctly put it, pugnacious. What I think that we have now is a recognition that has been the product of at least 3 years of discussion, debate, analysis, and I think some very, very committed effort to truly recognize what online learning can do for kids. Once we realized in International Falls, Minnesota, once we realized that online learning is as much with us today as a kid's cell phone, it became a question of not what are we going to do, but when are we going to start? And I think House File 553 represents a real solid start. It seems almost incongruous to say we're starting something 3 years after we've been in it. But I do think that happens sometimes. Under no circumstances would I wish to be interpreted as viewing House File 553 as putting up bulwarks or boundaries or barriers to online learning access for a student. What it does do, it not only provides for, but it demands that as a public school superintendent with my 1,400 students, that I do understand that online learning does provide opportunities for kids in an efficient, effective, and an accessible manner. What we're trying to do here, at least in my judgment, Mr. Chair, committee, is to understand that the way we operated schools in the almost 30 years I've been your superintendent, the way we operated schools worked well most of the time. If we're going to work better for even a greater amount of time, it's absolutely imperative that we recognize opportunity and not adversarial. Where we recognize access and not competition. and I think the House File 553 using online learning as the immediate example will allow that to happen. I'm very supportive of the bill, and I'm very hopeful for the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Superintendent Wagon. As the one journey, you and I have been on part of that journey together, certainly since 2007, so we appreciate your reflection, your words of wisdom as well. Members, we are going to want to move very quickly. These elements are inside the governor's bill. Obviously, there's one that we know of the commission is it, and when we go through the bill, we'll quickly identify where the differences might be. I think Representative Cartwright has a question.
Yeah, hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking
at
I see the exact word. The governor's except for lines 3.30 and 3.31. Where you're adding a must see enrolling district as a full-time online provider. I see that as being a good one. Could you explain that?
Sorry, Representative Dietrich. Yeah, and Representative McFarland, what was the reference?
3.31 and 3.30
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative McFarland, there are a couple of words that are different. And I will let Mr. Voss go through that history of that.
Mr. Voss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McFarland, I believe the intent there, similar to what is included in section line 4.1, is to include full-time online providers in the requirements of Subdivision 7 for certification and review, and just to make absolutely sure, because the preceding statement there is that an enrolling district that offers online learning to its enrolled students is not subject to the reporting requirements to review under Subdivision 7. But we want to ensure that if the enrolling district is a full-time online provider, they are still subject to those requirements. So it's the same effort to clarify that distinction.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Dietrich, with that, maybe just some quick thoughts before we lay this over, and then we'll pick up the policy bill, of which has very close similar language.
Yes, yes, and I can point out for us members very technical type changes. Mr. Chairman, thank you for this opportunity here today to help members get some more exposure to the option of online learning for students. And I think that this is just one of many options that help us realize that one-size-fits-all attitude does not always work, and that we need to have those other opportunities for certain segments of students. And now it is our job as policymakers to make sure that they are also enrolled, even if they do enroll in some sort of an alternative learning option, that it is still the best and the highest quality education that we can offer them in the state. And that they are prepared for some sort of post-secondary experience once they graduate from high school. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich, and Superintendent Wagon, thank you. We've made the long journey again. It's always good to see you. And Mr. Voss, thank you for your high professional, high quality work in this area. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, House File 553 is laid open for possible inclusion in the department or the education policy on this bill. Members, with that, we're last time on the agenda is House File 1179. It's a very simple bill, so we should never get through it in 5 minutes, no doubt. That's what we waited to do it at the very end, right? And Commissioner Seeger, welcome again. I was with the Commissioner a couple of days ago, and I was headed south very quickly with my, because it's very same kind of condition. You're headed north. I did wind up taking part of yesterday off and slept for a good check reaction. It really seems to have helped quite a bit. So you had my collegial empathy, because I know what you're going through as well. But thank you. Sorry to keep you waiting for as long as we have, but look forward to this walkthrough of the policy bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we do have an amendment to the
1179 bill is the D-809-0194 that needs to be moved.
Very well. So this, so let's do this. Make sure I'm doing everything correctly. The chair will move. House, what was the number? Chair moves House File 1171, which is 179. Chair moves House File 1179, the recommended pass. And I will then move the A090194 amendment.
Mr. Chair, as
you go through the bill, we will
highlight the parts of the amendment for you. And I'm going to let Michelle Weber, Chair Cornwell, the bill. We're actually back in Belcher today.
Good morning,
Dr. Melcher. She's going to go after 11 just because my voice is
gone.
But I'll jump in and
that's about the amendment. That puts the bill in the form that the department was just had it before us because this is the department policy bill. As indicated, the commissioner and the assistant commissioner will explain those additions. So all in favor of the 0194 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And the bill is amended and is before us in that form.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Michelle Weber with the Minnesota Department of Education. I'll walk through Article 1 for you. Section 1, lines 1.27 to lines 2.1, provide clarification between the responsibilities with respect to the Permanent School Trust Fund transfer between the Department of Management and Budget and the State Board of Investments. Section 2 of the bill, lines 2.14 to lines 2.18, allows for districts that are in pairing agreements to have an exception to the Labor Day start provision to accommodate construction projects that may be occurring with one of their member districts. Section 3, lines 2.31 and line 3.4 is somewhat of a technical correction. What it does is it changes the date by which the department is required to report financial data from January 15th to February 15th. Final audited card data is reported to the department on February 1st. So what this does is it eliminates the department's requirement to report preliminary data on January 15th and then follow up with final data after districts have reported their data on February 1st. Section 4, line 3.4, allows the department to report, this also is with respect to districts and statutory operating debt. It allows for us to report that after the final data has been submitted by districts. So it changes the date from January 1st to February 15th. Section 5 is related to other sections that I'll go through in just a few minutes. Line 4.22. What this does is it provides clarification that compensatory revenue is paid directly from the department to cooperative units with respect to tuition billing for special education. Section 6, lines 5.15 and lines 5.16. Provides a cross-reference to a provision that's already in statute requiring cultural exchange organizations to register with the Secretary of State. This is just including that in our general education statute as well. Section 7, lines 5.32 to line 6.2. This relates to what I just referred to in Section 5 with respect to clarifying that compensatory revenue with special education is paid directly from the department to the service. Section 8, line 6.11, also is a clarification of revenue paid directly to cooperative units. Section 9, line 6.31 to 6.34. This language was included in last year's bill, and what this does is provide an update with respect to lease levy for integration revenue with respect to changes that were made in the desegregation. Section 10, lines 8.12 to 8.15,
This eliminates the maintenance of effort requirement with respect to the state school levy, and this is reflective of a change that was made last year to require that at least $3 per pupil unit fee set aside for this purpose. And what this will do is allow more flexibility at the local level as districts might need to address budget reductions. Section 11, lines 10.13 through 10.15, are also related to compensatory revenue payments directly to service co-ops. And that concludes Article 1. We are going to have Dr. Mattson come up and walk through the provisions of Article 2 with respect to assessing.
Morning, Dr. Mattson.
Mr. Chair, members, Dirk Madison with the assessment for the department. I am first in a parade of folks from the department who will come and speak to areas of Article 2. Section 1 is simply a technical clarification that identifies when the state tests are aligned to the revision of standards. It has nothing to change the years or the schedule. It simply clarifies that as well as when school districts are required to have those standards in place, that is the year that was. State tests will change in simple clarification of language, and I'll make my colleague Dr. Ani regarding section 2.
Dr. Ani, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, this section changes the definition of course credit so that it reflects the requirements for graduation that schools must offer and the standards that must be delivered to students. Currently, we have two separate systems in Minnesota. We have our system of credits, our system of standards, but the two are not linked in this definition. As a result of this so-called credit loophole, or standards loophole, if you will, we have some students who are taking courses and earning credits for those courses, but those courses are lacking rigor. So this becomes a real question of equity for our students across different schools in Minnesota. What we want to do with this definition is make sure that we link state standards or local academic standards where state standards don't apply to the definition of course credit. And I'll be available for questions if you have any.
I'm told that not that we have not discussed this issue. Is that correct?
Yes. The effective date is for freshmen for next year.
That's what the event number by yourself. So.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Liz Myers, and I'm also on the department, and I'll be doing Section 3 of Article 2.
Good morning, Ms. Myers.
Right now, this section deals with AP, and right now the state does receive in their base appropriations money to reimburse AP exams and training for teachers. Right now, though, the training for the teachers part, most of the training occurs in the summer. So in the first year of the biennium, when the teachers take the training, it's very easy for us just to reimburse it. But at the end of the biennium, it is more difficult because training can come after June 30th, which is obviously, as you know, the end of the fiscal year for us. So what we are proposing is to actually take the money that we currently use for the reimbursement to teachers and turn that into possibly at our discretion a grant that goes to the higher institutions that then would pay for the teachers' training.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is John Millick. I'm also with the Minnesota Department of Education.
Good morning, Mr. Millick.
And I will be doing Section 4. Section 4 is to recognize students who spend a significant amount of time studying foreign languages. We would like to create a proficiency certificate to recognize listening, speaking, reading, and writing skills. This would be utilizing the American Council on Teachers of Foreign Languages intermediate low, intermediate low level on a valid and reliable assessment tool, and for languages listed Category 3 by the United States Foreign Service Institute, or Category 4 by the United States Department of Defense Institute. Those are typically more difficult languages, such as Korean, Chinese, Japanese, and Arabic. The standard is intermediate low for listening speaking and novice high for reading and writing. And then for students who excel even higher, we would look at a world language proficiency high achievement as a certificate, recognizing students demonstrate the listening, speaking, reading, and writing skills. Again, we'd be looking at pre-advanced level for the American Council Teaching Foreign Languages, and Category 3, Category 4 would be pre-advanced for listening, speaking, and intermediate mid for reading and writing. This certificate would also recognize students whose language, first language is not English. If they were to continue studying their native language, we'd want to make sure that they had the reading and writing piece with that as well.
So we're looking at the amendment use of that language of listening, speaking, reading, and writing as the measure of competencies as opposed to the kind of broader language that was in the original language here. I should know this, but I don't. When we say private as opposed to non-public, is there any important distinction here, or is that just... is this the language, or are there entities that fall into one that don't fall into others?
Well, one of the things that non-public opens up to are students who are homeschooled, and it allows them to be able to eligible for certificates as well.
Okay, thank you. So, Charles has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is actually a couple of those. World language proficiency certificate. If somebody were going to get a job as an interpreter, is that what they need to have to get that? Is that generally accepted standard that they are capable of getting a job
as an interpreter?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this was not developed for interpreters. This is more around the entry requirements for colleges, and this tends to be aligned with what the student would need to do to enter college-level ready world languages. This would be kind of the benchmark that's set at that level, not for the interpreter skills.
Okay. All right. Second question, then. And this also covers in multiple languages. The Chinese is mentioned here, but this covers French and Spanish.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this would cover any world language that was offered in a Minnesota school.
Yeah. So this will basically allow the department to play a role in recognizing these competencies as measured against these independent standards and the law that prefers certificate to Minnesota students that meet those. Very well. Oh, I'm sorry. Professor Newton, I should have known you might have a question.
Yeah, thank you.
Perhaps you can ask it in French.
Or Turkish.
Or Turkish.
Actually, the question is, has to go to the cost of the test and who actually administers the certificate, who delivers the certificate to the student.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a fantastic question, and I should have made a note to mention that. We want to set the guideline using these standards, but the assessment is something that's already being used at the local level. And so there will be no additional cost. It's recognizing work that's already being done, and it's giving a certificate to students who are already doing this level of accomplishment. It's just a new tool to recognize the good things we're already doing in other Minnesota schools.
Dr. Manson.
Mr. Chair, members, Dirk Manson here for the department. I'm just going to briefly touch on sections 5 and 6 on Article 2. There are a couple of just technical adjustments in line 1420 and 1422, just making some clarification language there. 1424 through 29 identifies the state to be able to require schools to participate in national and state field testing or national sampling. This actually, while it sounds like it's an increased burden, is actually intended to reduce the burden both at the department and for schools. We're able to select those schools one time and promise that we won't come back to them in the near future. As it is right now, we have no ability to require them to participate. And so it becomes a blanket invitation to everyone, hoping we'll get the right sampling that's available, statistically appropriate, phone calls, et cetera, made in that time. So we believe we can decrease the burden both on schools and our staff in continuing that that procedure.
Mr. Rice, I'm curious, how do you enforce promising never to come back to them again?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I did make the clarifying phrase in the near future.
We'll
go back to the pool once again in sometime. And then finally, in starting on 1435 and to the top of the next page, is just asking for permission to phase out the basic skills test. That becomes an increased cost. This is something that many states do when their tests have phased out over time, and checking whether technical experts, that's an appropriate amount of time to allow for that. Then we move on to Section 6, which is a very small change, which is at the beginning of page 17, 17-2, and that simply is allowing us to have the flexibility the federal government granted us to test students in high school in biology in ninth grade, and not teachers in 10th grade. There are ninth graders who are taking biology as well, and it's, again, just a technical change. And that concludes Section 6.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brian, again, and I'm going to do Section 7 and 8, and this is actually a request from the Board of Teaching. Thank you. They are requesting that currently, the way that it stands, if a teacher on the Board of Teaching retires, they cannot finish out the rest of their term. So this is just a request asking that if a teacher on the board retires during their term, that they can finish out their term. And this just needs to be changed into a teacher.
Mr. Chairman, Morgan Brown with the Education Department. I'm going to fish out the remainder of Article 2.
Morning, Mr. Brown.
Good morning. Sections 9 through 11, I'll deal with alternative programs, and most of this is clarifying language to make clear that there are actually three types of state-approved alternative programs: area learning centers that serve multiple districts or multiple schools, alternative learning programs which are within a particular school, and then contracted alternatives which currently only exist in the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts. In terms of a policy, that's later on when you'll see any kind of policy change. It's in a later section regarding the alternative programs. Section 12 on line 4113 says that a school district, as long as they have a public meeting and allow public comment, they do not actually have to go through the provisions of subdivision 5 of this statute to have a full public hearing if it's going to be just a temporary closure of the schoolhouse for 3 years or less, and it's going to continue to, and then the public still has a chance to comment on the schoolhouse's future. And this is a request that came to us from the St. Paul School District and several other school districts. Beginning on Section 13 is the online learning language that you just talked about and represented teachers bill. And if I can just clarify two things, there is one way in which the language is different in the department's bill from Representative Dietrich's bill. That is on in Section 16 that begins on line 25-15, where we reestablish the Online Learning Advisory Council that was originally established by the legislature several years ago and then sunsetted last year. One thing I'll note is in the amendment that is was offered at the beginning is that we do delete down in line 25-18 the reference to Section 15.059, which is a section of law whereby the advisory council members have a right to per diems and mileage reimbursement and that type of thing. And so we're trying to make that cost neutral by deleting the reference to that section. So this advisory council would exist, but the members wouldn't automatically receive per diems or reimbursement of mileage. That would be left up to the discretion of the department. The other area that I want, and I apologize, I was out of the room when this was being discussed on Representative Dietrich's bill, is just alleviate any confusion. The other language that there was concern with maybe missing from the department's bill, actually is in the department's bill, but it's in the technical correction section on Article 7, Section 10, and that's the language that clarifies the original intent of the online learning law, that all full-time online learning providers also have to be certified under the provisions of the online learning statute. So that actually isn't there, just like it would represent to you still.
You're in agreement on that. Can I just ask you very quickly back on page 24, line 24.33?
Mm-hmm.
See the word assurance. So what does that mean? What does it mean to have an insurance?
Mr. Chairman, the way this would work, and the way it has worked when the online learning law was originally enacted, is that we did receive a signed written assurance from the online learning provider, and then we would essentially do various kinds of spot check or verification, both initially when they apply to certify and during as we monitor them when they're in operation. What it gets away from is the discussion of Representative Dietrich's bill, is this idea that we had to have paperwork from each online provider for each one of their online learning courses down to the benchmark level, which as was referenced, resulted in them delivering boxes of paperwork to the department that wasn't that useful for the school districts, which is really who wanted to see verification that they were meeting standards and both state academic standards and other kinds of standards for quality online learning programs.
It just seems like an odd word to me, maybe written statement.
And Mr. Chairman,
some kind of quick roll call with assurance implies not a big deal.
And Mr. Chairman, Ms. Larson and I already had a discussion on this, and I think we will be able to come up with some alternative language in that area.
Thank you.
Beginning on top of page 26, section 17 and a number of pages that follows are all the department's charter schools.
Mr. Brown, it would not be my intention for us to walk through the charter school provisions here. As members know, we passed out the smoking bill last week.
And just to clarify, Mr. Chairman, the language that's in here is identical to the language that was in House File 935 that the committee held as originally introduced, and obviously there were amendments and changes added to that. So.
Thank you.
Going on to on page 43, section 19, beginning on line 4329, this is again more clarifying language on alternative programs. And then when you get over to section 21, on line 4513, and this is impacted also by the amendment at the beginning, the intent here with the combination of clause 2 on 4513 and clause 6 on 4518. Is to make clear that districts have the ability to appropriately refer students to alternative programs even if they're not determined to be one full year behind. And so the amendment actually deletes the language in at least 1 year. And this really is, frankly, to be consistent with practice in the field where if districts or other educators are concerned that a student is substantially falling behind, that they don't have to wait for their student to be one full year behind before they provide them a referral as clarified in Clause 6. Section 22, which goes over on the top of page 46, again, more clarification language. The language on the top of page 46 just is making the language in this section of the law consistent with the PSEO section of the law. Then going down to section 25, which begins at the very bottom of page 46. This language makes clear that if it's a district other than a resident district that places a pupil in a care and treatment program, that the resident district must be notified and have an opportunity to participate in the placement decision discussion. And then if you go down to line 4716, it also says that when a child is temporarily placed in a day program, as opposed to a residential program, in a day program, and the child continues to live within the district of residence, during the care and treatment, that the district is responsible for providing transportation. But it clarifies here that the district may establish reasonable restrictions on the transportation unless the child is court-ordered into the care and treatment program.
Before you jump forward, your amendment does add a section actually prior to this, and this is the only problem with family education.
Right, and actually it's just changing that section 25, it's just changing that title line of on 4630, that's the amendment.
That's sort of the, on the agenda on line 149 that deals with revenue issues here.
Actually,
1.19, I'm sorry. Of the amendment.
Sections 1.15 through 2.2 is actually aligning current practice of how the department administers the allocation of annual appropriations to DOD programs in American Indian tribal schools, contract schools. Since 1991, the legislature has annually appropriated $68,000 for the DOD programs in the contract schools. And at that time, this language, this being struck in lines 119 through 121, was put into the statute. However, the department doesn't collect the data that's needed to appropriate the formula in this way. So at that time, the Indian Education Office administered that, put in the department and administered the program as grant. And we just kind of realized that we're asking to have the language changed for the study of the
Commissioner, what's happening with American Indian? I don't want to open up a whole new can of worms, so I'm just curious about the status of American Indian. I think it's official labor, like an advisory group, the commission, and I know it's been a source of kind of back and forth for a couple of years.
Mr. Chair, and we are continuing our advisory group. We also have worked probably for almost 2 years now. With a task force that actually was bringing forth a number of proposals, some of them in regard to standards implementation, making sure that within all of our standards that the American Indian heritage and culture and even academic implementation of standards would reflect that. There are a number of other recommendations. One would be to create, once again, American Indian position. Our department, we've requested some appropriation for that. We can go back to the history about how that, was all kind of fractured and the different components were put into different agencies even. But right now, Assistant Commissioner Brown and myself and two or three others in the agency are actually working directly with the tribes at this point, attending American Indian Council meetings and traveling around the state working with the different tribes because we don't have a designated person right now in our department, but we are representing all of their needs through different people that are in the agency.
So it's safe to say that whatever, maybe whatever it might be a big, the recommendations that come forward from the task force are currently not in motion in terms of.
Some of them are, Mr. Chair, some of them we are implementing. If you look at our science standards, you're going to see how we are incorporating some of the American Indian contributions to science in our standards and students learn about those and study those and also use the strategies the American Indians have had in relationship to their environment.
My name is not Dr. Melcher. I'm going to do my best to explain what is another technical provision, but it's an attempt to clear up and make consistent how alternative programs generate certain types of aid with what is current statute. And if you have additional questions about that, we can get back to you on that. Section 28 at the top of page 52 is clarifying the provision of law, the currently provision law that allows essentially schools to designate themselves as project-based schools and have their ADMs calculated on that basis, which means when we go in to do an audit, the ADMs are calculated not based on seat time, but on project completions, and that's how they're structured for those students. And we felt we needed to have some both clarifying and strengthening language in here to make clear what those programs are, and also the commissioner's authority to approve when a program is going to be considered in that way for calculating ADMs. And then sections 29 and 30 are just revival and reenactments for both the Online Learning Council and the Charter School Advisory Council, which was in the department's original language.
I'm going to walk through Article 3. Section 1 of Article 3 is actually aligning simple notifications for when students enroll or in a place inside of Edmonton English language program. This actually kind of helps clear up some confusion on the part of the school district. Right now, the state says 10 days and the city federal requirements say they have 30 days. So we're just aligning to kind of help start to it. Clarification on what data is supposed to be notified by. Section 2 is extending the interagency coordinating council. This is required by federal law for special education, federally sponsored special education, and it's also received fines through from the federal government as well. Section 3.
Mr. Chairman, Section 3 is a proposal that was brought to us by the State Academies for Deaf, Hard of Hearing, and Blind Visually Impaired, whereby a parent could choose to enroll their child in either of those academies for a 60-day trial placement, and at the end of which the academy staff and the parents would get together to determine whether that was an appropriate placement on a continuing basis. There was a desire from the academies and a number of parents to do this because currently the only way a child can be placed, can enroll in those academies, is if they receive a referral or are placed there under their IEP in their district in which they're enrolled.
Section 4 removes the Catholic Institute in 1997 for the administrative costs retained by the Department of Human Services on reimbursement to school districts through medical assistance and special education services. The Department of Human Services has requested removal of this cap for several years, and it was not on the bill last year due to an increased cost of salaries and benefits from inflation and union negotiations. There's still the 5% cap that they have. They can only do a 5% for administrative costs, but this restricts the not exceeding the $350,000.
So we'll just leave that just open-ended. So at one point, the legislative body was going to put a cap of some form, and there's no cap, and so this might be more of an issue for someone than finance. I don't know if it's DHS or others, but.
Thank you. Thank you
Mr.
Chair.
Yeah.
Member
Sabatka.
My name is Susan Costamano, and I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. As this gentleman mentioned, and I don't know the name, the tax would still exist in the form of the 5%, which is very typical for our program. We have a lot of programs that can take the ministers for that 5% workforce. I'd be happy to explain more about the program.
So I misunderstood that. There is a cap. Okay. Very well. I wonder if we can just back up really quickly, back on Section 3. This is for a placement that would allow for a direct ability for the parents to apply. Is that correct? I don't know this issue at all, but I mean, I suspect that there was a was a reason why we didn't do that in the first place. And so we went through the IEP, through the district, going through the IEP. I know that this is a kind of trial basis, and trial basis, meaning that eventually there would be an IEP thing or determination.
Mr. Chairman, in terms of speaking to what the original intent of the language, I'd have to go back and talk to the academy since this is their proposal that came forward. But yes, the idea is obviously once the student is enrolled in either the academies, an IEP would be put together for them, and that would certainly be in place before the end of the 60-day trial placement. There was clearly, we heard from both parents and the academies, who wanted parents to have this additional public education option to directly enroll their child, but also obviously wanted to safeguard in case that was just a totally inappropriate placement for that child. So that's why they have a 60-day trial placement, and that was reviewed by their legal counsel at the Attorney General's office to make sure it was consistent with federal regulations and providing FAPE.
I think to set up a scenario where we're placing children and then you have subsequent withdrawal.
Mr. Chair, it might be good to bring the academies here to talk specifically about the sort of representing them. It's my understanding that they have received a lot of requests from parents to place their students, but the school district actually controls that. So I think it's probably good for the academies to explain, why they want to do a trial period. I think you made a good point that this may not work out. Parents may think that this would be a good venue for a blind child or a totally deaf child. But I think it would be better if you maybe as you move forward and if it's in Brookstone grounds or anything, I want to ask them more of what the process would be for it. Because I don't remember all the rationale as far as why, except that there is no ability for a parent to do this. It has to come directly from the commissioner.
Commissioner, why don't we have a framework for parents to just simply...
I don't know, and I think that's why I think the history, I think the academies may know that history is better than I do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question, and this might go to the academies also. I don't know, are those students lodged at the academies? Yeah, so even on the 60-day trial, they would be lodged there? Okay, thank you.
For the record, the answer is yes.
Mr. Chair, in some cases, the student may be, so close by that they wouldn't be there over 100 hours in residence. It could be a child that was in terrible or a close town, and they're not driving there. Are the school district the same for them? It wouldn't necessarily all be the same over, but for those that were, on the street, far away, they would be there.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Chair, this gets back. The question I was leading up to is whether a child who's deaf or blind lives in another school district, if the resident school district would have to pay the cost of transportation of that child if they're not staying. So I think maybe that should be addressed when we look at the Happy Academies report.
Thank you. We'll take note of that, perhaps we can even just begin to shoot over some questions to the folks at the academies. Ms. Parker.
Mr. Chair, I'll go on with Article 4. Article 4, Section 1 is aligning the name of the library with its actual purpose and how it's known by patrons. Section 2 is requesting the library to be able to have telephone and electronic meetings. The library is in Faribault, and most of its advisory members are throughout the state and have disabilities that make it hard for them to be able to travel to the meetings. So this just allows them, as long as they meet these requirements, so that the meetings will be open and accessible to allow them to have these types of meetings. This also is already exists. The State Rehabilitation Council for the Blind, the Statewide Independent Living Council, Minnesota Veterans Home Board of Directors. And I know in the Senate, I actually haven't seen it yet in the House, but there's a bill up for the Indian Affairs Council to also be able to do this.
Members, these provisions of the library, seriously, I have a part of last year's omnibus policy bill, and in addition to a few others, I think we've gone over. Which was vetoed by the governor, and so we're back here again with the same language. Section Article 5?
Yes, Article 5 is actually a form that has been funded and already heard in the Early Childhood Committee, House File 1026. Two sections, though, are not under Early Childhood
from these jurisdictions, so I would like to cover them here, and those are sections 10 and 11 on page 61. This is a repealing of an advisory council that was required in earlier versions of federal education laws for the state.
This part is, I'm sorry, if you have a question before you get to
Yes. Sorry,
Representative Demers.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm lagging just a bit, but on page 56, the cost of electronic meetings for the Minnesota Braille and Talking Library, one of the, and I don't know who makes up the committees, but to do those by telephone, any provision for people who may be blind and or deaf to be able to participate also in these electronic meetings? That I didn't see that, but I'm going to make an assumption that that's taken into consideration. I assume there are some people with those conditions on these committees.
Ms. Pardon. Actually, for some changes, I know a person that works over in Department of Human Services with this library as well, and I do understand from them that there is. I'm not for sure what the technology is, but there is a way for them to participate over the phone. Also, it is electronic as well, so WebEx and other things would be also
familiar with. Okay. I assume that would be the case, so thank you, President. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, back on page 61, section 10 removes an advisory council that is no longer required by federal law. It used to be required under the state and drug-free schools for advisory teams, the school districts, in order for them to receive funding, but with the No Child Left Behind requirements, this was repealed. And the federal requirements, at this time, districts have institutionalized the advisory team's responsibilities into other advisory councils or boards that they have, and there is no funding actually connected to this committee, and there is no support for it, so asking for that to be repealed. Article 6 is actually language that the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget has asked to be included to clarify that the Department of Education can receive grants and gifts. Currently, if this language was not included, we still have the ability through other state statutes, but this just kind of aligns our agency with other agencies that do have this specific language in their own statutes. So, again, the Minnesota Management Budget has requested to help clarify our authority to
offer. Mr. Chair, to that point, is that only monetary gifts?
Mr. Chair, in addition, we might receive a technical assistance grant. I believe this committee received a presentation earlier this year from an organization in Chile. And so they didn't apply, they didn't designate funding to the department, but they are providing technical assistance and I assume so. It would not be, the department does not receive necessarily gifts of significant monetary value. That would be an item that might be given with a wash.
No personal gifts.
Right, correct. There are individual employment assets provisions that we have to, that would apply. So,
thank you. Dr. Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to slow down, too. The repealer on page 61, that relates to section 10 and section 11. Is that correct? I just wanted to...
Mr. Chair, yes, I'm sorry. I missed that on the line.
Oh, yeah, I think you said it, but I thought about it in a different order. So.
Well, actually, on the amendment, the repealer before the amendment includes language that is like in the clone house file, 1026. It also was unintentional on our part to actually repeal that whole statute. Instead, we, in early childhood committee, brought it back up and just struck the language we found in the whole.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Dirk Madsen again with the department. These are in Article 7 are purely technical recommendations to Section 1 deals with just eliminating the cross-reference and corralling the assessment language into 120B.30. It's in some places kind of spread out across statute. This is addressed more specifically in 120B.30. Sections 2 and 3, so lines 63.11 through 63.16, and then similar language on 65.3. Both of those sections deal with the ability to exempt students from assessments. Both IDEA and NCLB do not allow for that exemption. We do provide alternate assessments for those students, but we're not allowed to exempt those students under federal law. This is just bringing those two pieces into coordination.
Mirrors our assessment values in line with full-time standards for all students, but obviously accommodating in terms of how we would assess those.
Correct, Mr. Chair. And then finally, for my purposes, Section 4 is finally a recommendation to strike language of the Commissioner making statistical adjustments specifically in the reporting of test results. That deal with things like number of single-parent families, parents' level of education, parents' income level. The department does not nor cannot collect parent income levels, et cetera. And it's just simply something we do not do currently, and again, just to bring in line with current practice.
And Dr. Madsen, that one hurts, because if you know, at least I'm just looking at it, you know, quickly, it's like, as a policymaker, it's kind of information I'd like to be able to have, and I suspect that there's some history here in terms of when this language was added in and why. But it's essentially the department's position that the requirement here is based on data that the department either simply doesn't collect or can't collect because it's not being collected, or perhaps data privacy issues, you know, factor in.
Yes. Correct, Mr. Chair. So, for example, there are some things like residential instability, in other words, mobility. We do report on that, and we'll continue to report on that, but there, I guess we could lift that particular strike through, but again, we do that in all of our disaggregation of reporting and so forth, and you're right. It's just, I guess I would rule the memo that I would have to send out to districts to say, please collect parent income or marital status, et cetera.
Well, Professor Peterson, I think that's a question.
I actually want to go back to 6.32, and way back at the beginning, and I just assumed that everybody would be around, and I don't know if these people can answer or not. But I wanted to know the implications of the seizures on 6.31, and it's under the least purchase in its own size, and why the change, and why the specific legislation.
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, this language does look like it has far-reaching implications because of some of the terms that we need tonight. However, this is language that just simply aligns with decisions that were made to reduce segregation with respect to critical aligning of the language.
Commissioner
Brown has left me.
Dr. Melcher
is
still with me,
but it's my understanding from both Dr. Melcher and Assistant Commissioner Brown that this does not impact the integration program or integration revenue. It is just a correction to align to when with the energy segregation.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Peters.
And
sometimes
get the reference in the impact of it, and you know, many of the districts do that in the school. And I assume this applies also to charter schools too. And I'm not understanding. I agree that it's, you know, I can certainly understand it might conform to federal law, but what are the implications for school districts?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Peterson. Ms. Weber, our charter schools are currently not subject to these
correct
rules.
And my understanding is that schools will not be a change. This is more of an alignment of
the way teams are defined. However, I will set up a time for Dr. Melcher to meet with you and talk to you about this. So we'll be on our team.
Well, charter schools are currently not, my understanding, not subject to the study. So
they're not,
so they're going to be regular.
The
fact that they are. So we're going to represent movies from the rest of the foundation. Just a little bit of it. Very well. Any other end of the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 5 of Article 7 is providing, oh, many of the sections I'm going to be walking through, you also did see last year in the department's policy bill. We are providing, correcting a cross-reference on lines 66.15 and 66.16 to the appropriate statutory provisions. Section 6 is updating, several lines of the section are updating data that the clerk record reports, and this is just in alignment with other sections of the law. On line 67.1, I do want to draw your attention to the provision that we're striking on the clerk record reporting the condition and value of school property. This is an obsolete report that has not been done for several years. Section 7, we do have the amendment references this section as well. Line 67.22 of the bill through 67.24, as well as line 67.27 and line 67.28, are eliminating references to obsolete requirements. They're requirements that date back to 1977. The amendment is with respect to line 67.26. And it is striking state board pursuant, and then adding pursuant to chapter 14, and then inserting commissioner to be in alignment with the Commissioner of Education's responsibilities under this program. Section 8, line 68.1, is also eliminating an obsolete reference. Section 9, line 68.5 through line 68.7. 68.5 through 68.7, is also eliminating an obsolete provision dating back to 1979. And Assistant Commissioner Brown has left. Section 10 has to do with online learning requirements. And these are some of the provisions, I believe, that also are in Representative Dietrich's bill. And so we did have the provisions in two separate places identifying what were technical provisions versus policy changes with respect to online. Section 11 clarifies reporting with respect to charter schools, and that they actually submit these. On line 70.7, it's the audit report that we receive, not just the management letter. Section 12 has to do with gift receipts. This is with respect to the state academies. Line 70.21 through 70.22, they provide clarifying authority similar to the language that we have in the state agency article, allowing the state academy to receive gift funding. Gift is what is referred to in statute, typically applies to foundational funds or things of that nature. Section 13, line 7.30 and 7.34. Provides clarifying language. This was brought to our attention. We have, through the service cooperatives, we have regional low incidence grants that we fund to them. And what this is doing is it's providing clarification about what is considered direct services. They have models of providing services to special education students that they utilize, and this clarifies current practice with respect to funding. Section 14 is a correction based on a law that was enacted in 2007 with respect to the QCOM revenue. And this, we have letters from the chairs of the committee indicating that this was an omission. And this was in our bill last year also, and so this is providing clarification of the funding for QCOM. Section 15, line 7.24 through 72.4, line 72.7, removes the requirement for non-resident districts to notify a resident district if they're providing special education services to a student.
And the reason that this is no longer required is that the department has a tuition billing process, and we pay the funds directly to the non-resident district.
The repealers and repellers. I guess I don't see this. Thank you. Robert, thank you for individuals who have been part of the block. To the bill. We will be taking the bill up again next week, and we'll go through the process of chair and committee amendments. We have been somewhat of a study communication with department staff, just trying to clarify pieces here. So my hope is that when the chair comes in with his amendments, those don't come as last-second surprises to you, so hopefully we'll be able to turn those around as quick as possible. Mr. Heller, you wished to offer some quick testimony. We are over our time, so come on forward. I'll ask you to be as quick as you can be. Mr. Heller, welcome.
Oh, my name is Rick Heller. Testifying on this bill is called 1179. One thing I took notice is PSCO, it's my understanding, I'm not for clarification when that starts, it's my understanding, I think the last bill we had here was 1701, which I think touched on the, again, back to the blind and deaf piece. Again, it gets into the 1701.1. Again, NYMA says, in order to be eligible for NYMEC data, which is NYMA's files, you have to fall under that specific area under a blind and deaf. Again, that is a disability. It is specific from LD. We get in the online, though. Online, in this document, I see 5435, and then supplemental one for 6917, talking books, again, we're getting in the NYMIS now, 5532 through 561. That relates with, again, if you want to write this down, these are U.S. codes, 1474 D and A, and 1474 E and B. You both find print disability. Again, those specific areas get into the library end of it. And I think it's real relevant when you start going online and all these kids that may have print disabilities. I call them reading disorders, not LD specifically, maybe, but this gentleman here I had last said it was. Again, it needs to align because these kids won't get FAPE. It's important that they get the FAPE according to federal guidelines. And again, it gets in a timely manner. And my son has never gotten in a timely manner. I've always gotten pushed off by an OPS. And getting the books and get them in print and get a degree that a reader would work to get to. Again, get the words into them. If anybody wants to talk to me, I'd be glad to sit down to share more specific data. We're running out of time. I understand it. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And we do have people here from the department who heard the testimony, and perhaps Mr. Heller, you and the department folks can get together and talk about those particular issues.
Thank you. It's frustrating when Pacific people leave, and I had Pacific issues that were even underlying in here, and I had clarification, but when I can't really ask them, then who do I ask, you know, and it makes that difficult for me.
If you have a department person here, and I'm sure that she would be more willing to help you connect with those particular individuals among her staff members. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Farewell, members. So the next week we'll go through a process. I'll come in with an amendment to the department policy bill. I will try to give you as much a heads up as possible in terms of what I am proposing to do relative to that. And then we'll go through a process on Wednesday, and I believe also on Thursday, of sharing amendments from committee members relative to this bill, and I hope that is the case to fill out at the end of next week. So with that,
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to ask, do we need to have a formal written amendment to the bill, or can we do verbal amendments? How do you feel?
Well, my preference for, it's a great question, my preference for the city union is to have written amendments. We don't have a 24-hour rule in this committee, as you know, many of our committees do, and you know, you kind of live and you die by that. I'm really just pretty much counting on the level and spirit of collegiality that we've had here and openness in terms of sharing as best as possible. Now, we have, and even today you saw it a bit in your bill, Representative Dabney's bill, the language came in with not most of our members having had enough to look at that. That felt okay with me because we weren't moving anything today relative to those bills, and I also understood that that had more to do with the fact that we were trying to balance the needs of several stakeholders. I think we were, you and Representative Dabney in particular, and some of the other members have tried to very carefully get to a point of negotiating out positions. And so you had a working process that was leading right up to this process. But, those are occasionally you'll have bills where that's the case. To a degree where it doesn't require that kind of sophisticated choreography collaborating among different groups, I would urge you to get your ideas in formed as quickly as possible and get them in a written form. I'll be flexible. I will entertain some verbal oral amendments, but pretty much in the spirit that I have done so throughout this session, which is very good. It's been really primarily technical nature.
I was just looking out for our resident advisor.
That's why I'm trying to head off for Mr. Obermiller.
Thank you. If I could, though, we shouldn't expect from you, I take it, a delete all amendment. We should be making written amendments to the bill as it was introduced today. Yes, we have them drafted.
I would say, Representative Obermiller, you're not going to be offering amendments on Tuesday. You'll be offering amendments on Wednesday. If I have a delete all, you'll have a delete all to look at.
Very good. Thank you.
Very well. Members, until next Tuesday, this committee stands adjourned.